Are you ready for the summer?
Yeah.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody.
My favorite season.
Episode 71 of GBW Podcast. I'm Chris. With me, as always, is Mr. Josh over there.
Hey.
How's it going?
It's summer. How do you think it's going?
We actually haven't seen each other in like 5 weeks.
Is it 5 weeks?
Something like that. God. Because we recorded a big marathon with Vince D'Amato. Yeah. 2 episodes worth, 5.5 hours of talking in one night. I'm never fucking doing that again.
A break.
I'm never doing it again.
Yeah.
But I went away.
Never say never.
I went away on vacation, and that's why I got the inspiration to talk about summer camps like we're going to today. And then I was like, let's do a top five summer camps. Why not? Blah, blah, blah. Josh comes to me 2 days ago. He's like, dude, I don't have five.
This is the weakest topic for me in the history of the show.
I figured what we'll do when we get to that point is I'm going to talk about my top five.
Okay.
And I didn't write anything else down, but I know you wrote down a bunch of stuff.
I did.
And I'm sure I can chime in on it.
I'm sure you can.
All right. So let's start, however, as usual, with what we've been watching. And would you like to start?
I'll start with a quick one.
All right.
Just because I didn't get to the theater a lot while you were away, but I did go to see Dunkirk.
Right.
The new Christopher Nolan movie, which is one that I was quite excited about for this year, and apparently for good reason. I was saying to you earlier at dinner, this is probably the number one movie I'd say in the last decade for me for recommending that you see it in the theater.
Right.
Because in the theater, this thing was just outstanding. I didn't see it in IMAX, but I did see it in Ultra AVX. And I would highly recommend this movie in particular, spending a bit of extra money and seeing it on a big screen with like a kick-ass sound system. And because this thing brought me like right into the war. I think more than any other movie, I've actually felt the horrors of war in this one. And I thought it was just outstanding. When I originally walked out of it, I did feel like it was like a 5 out of 5. I've since lowered that a little bit, only because there's not a lot of character development. But just as an overall spectacle and just a filmmaking achievement, I just thought it was fantastic. And I think Nolan should absolutely be up for Best Director this year. I don't know if a lot of people know this, but Nolan is not a big fan of CGI, and he is a big fan of the theatrical experience.
Yeah. I've been seeing a lot of stuff lately about him being anti Netflix and everything. So
yeah,
and that's been going on for a while. So it makes sense that this would be a movie you would see in theatrically.
Preferably. Well, exactly. And this is like epic. Like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff with ships, obviously. If you know the story, you'll know why. But it's basically a rescue off a beach. But like a lot of the ships were real. A lot of the ships were actually from Dunkirk, the original historical event. The stuff in airplanes was actually shot in Spitfires, or they used actual Spitfires. It was just like a lot of the scenes where you see giant crowds on the beaches, it was actually extras. I know he used like some cardboard cutouts, but overall it was like the real deal. So this is like just kind of like old school filmmaking with like a modern edge, and just completely blew me away. So I know there's been a lot of mixed reviews about this. Not a lot, but I mean, some people are like, complaining about the character development piece, which I can understand. But if you just go in and let yourself go, it just completely overtakes you, and was really quite the spectacle. So highly recommend it, it's particularly seeing it in theaters. I don't know if this is going to translate well to watching it at home. You just won't get the same effect. So I would really recommend people go see it and, like I said, spend a bit extra money and see it in a good theater with all the bells and whistles. So check it out.
Well, it's like I said to you at dinner, too, about this movie, is that it's like, for most war movies, they're clocking in at 2.5 to 3 hours long, and this one's like only like 1 hour 47 or something. And
yeah,
and that's actually pretty short even for a Nolan movie, because like even his Batman movies are like 2.5 hours each.
It is, but you know, that like I said to you also, like this isn't like any war movie I've ever seen.
Right.
Like this basically is just throwing you into the action, and you're kind of in it. like you're kind of like, so you're there, like it's pretty overwhelming. So like, yeah. I think going much longer than what I did would be too much. It's just too much of a immersive experience.
Sounds like it's basically the first hour of Saving Private Ryan,
like the first, you know, that battle at the beginning of Saving Private. Think of that for like, because an like, entire movie.
Because when I saw Saving Private Ryan back in the day,
yeah,
that was like that opening scene which goes on for an hour. I'm like,
is it an hour? I thought it was like 20 minutes or
no,
something.
No, it's almost an hour. It's like 45 minutes to an hour. I'm sitting there with my jaw on the floor.
Yeah.
And then it's over and I look at the thing. I'm like, holy shit, this movie's already been on that long.
Yeah.
Because I just couldn't take my attention away from it. And if this is very similar to that, I'm probably going to dig it too, because
yeah,
that's like one of my favorite war scenes is the opening of Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah, it's really cool. But it, like I said, it doesn't have the character development of Saving Private
Ryan.
Well,
that's why Saving Private Ryan's almost 3 hours long.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of war movies, like my favorite's always been Platoon,
yeah,
which it may still be, because I, like I said, I don't know how this is going to translate, you know, once it's out of the theaters and we're like looking at watching it on TV at home for the rest of our lives. I don't know if it's going to be the same experience.
But I also find for my age range that stories about Vietnam,
yeah,
are a little bit more close to home for me personally.
Yeah.
Because my parents would have been of the age where they could have possibly had to have fought in Vietnam.
Right.
So I think that's kind of why those movies resonate with me personally, for like being in my 40s. And,
yeah,
you know, when Vietnam was going on, my mom would have only been like, you know, 22, 23 years old. Like,
yeah,
more, our parents would have been in that age where it's quite possible they could have gone and fought or whatever. And I think that's why that war has always been like kind of more.
Well, I find like in movies, particularly about Vietnam, yeah, it's easier to relate to the characters too,
yeah,
because they're more like contemporary. They're more like us. Like that was only in the 60s and early 70s.
Right.
And also the music here, there's also a lot of music that we can relate to. Yeah. So it's different. It's more relatable. This is just like an onslaught, which is, it was great. So
cool.
Check it out in the theater though.
All right.
Yeah.
Wicked, wicked. I went to the movies too, but I'll talk about those a little later.
Okay.
I'm going to talk about, I'm going to get this out of the way just because I'm going to continue my trend. And that I sat
bad
through.
To good?
No. It's not bad, but it's not good. I watched Police Academy 6.
This is good, by
what
the way.
What is that?
It's the...
We're talking about booze right now.
The hard orange cream soda.
You're so studly right
which
now.
You have one of too, I
that's,
might add.
That's true.
Yeah, so back off.
So I watched Police Academy 6. City Under Siege.
Oh, dude.
Got one left.
Even I'm getting tired of
it. Dude, I got one left. One left. I'm going to go over this real quick because there's not tons to say. You've seen one Police Academy movie. You've basically seen them all. This is better than 5. It's better than Assignment Miami Beach. It is about basically the Police Academy guys have to try and stop a crime wave that's going through the city where all these criminals are going and stealing jewels and all sorts of valuables. And it's like, oh, there's an informant in the police station. We have to figure out who it is. That's basically the plot. Stop laughing.
Is Jones back?
Fuck him. He is. So the reason this movie's better than 5 is because, first of all, it doesn't really try and be more like the villain in this one's just totally ridiculous because it's like three like thug guys. One of them is Garrett Graham,
okay,
from Phantom of the Paradise and Chud 2, Bud the Chud, and but their main guy is this guy who they call Mr. Big, and through the whole movie he's just standing, he's behind this fogged over glass in a silhouette, smoking a cigar, talking to them through a microphone. So it's kind of like old school, kind of Dick Tracy-ish.
Kind of like the guy in Deal or No Deal?
Yeah, sort of like that. So, but it's like kind of Dick Tracy and it's like delivery. And, you know, I liked that better than in Part 5 where it was just like these Miami diamond thieves and stuff. I thought that was kind of stupid. This is more silly and more in line with the later Police Academy movies. Lots of pranks in this because, of course, Harris and Proctor are in this and they're always the victims.
Yeah.
Lots of slapstick stuff. But there's a couple of jokes in here that actually worked. There's a gag in it where, you know how there's that like cliche that anytime in a movie when there's a car chase and there's a fruit stand, it gets destroyed,
yeah,
like obliterated. In this movie, there's a scene where they're going towards a fruit stand and they actually avoid hitting it, but they mention it like, don't destroy the fruit stand. So that's kind of an amusing joke, okay, for what it was.
Is that the highlight?
No. They brought back Bruce Mahler was in parts 1 through 3 as this character called Fackler. And he's kind of this nerdy guy with glasses, and he's actually back in part 6.
Okay, the little guy, right?
Yeah, like he's a little...
He was buddies with Hightower.
Yeah, he's a little nerdy... Not that guy, this is the other guy. This is the one whose wife also joined the Academy, and like when he was going to recruit in part 1, she's hanging off his car.
I think I remember, okay.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he's back, and he's like one of those guys where he's so oblivious to being like a hazard because he always knocks stuff over, hits people with stuff without knowing about it, and everyone tries to avoid him. There's a gag involving him involving a water fountain that I kind of liked, and that was the highlight of the movie, actually. And, you know, and of course, we've got motherfucking Jones, played by, what's-his-face there, Michael Winslow, fuck him. Not him personally, just the character of Jones. There's a scene where in the finale where they have a big citywide blackout, and there's all these people in a comedy club who are, like, getting upset, and for some reason, Jones decides to jump on stage and do some stand-up. And one of his stand-up routines is pretending to be fucking Jimi Hendrix, and it's awful.
Wow.
It's really
awful.
Didn't
we see him do that on The Gong Show?
Probably. I really cannot stand this character in the series, and I've been saying that since, like, part 2
or 3.
I
loved him when I was a kid.
Yeah, it doesn't work. He's in Cheech and Chong, one of the Cheech and Chong movies, too, we'll be watching soon, so get ready for that, buddy. And, it wasn't bad. When you're 6 movies deep... You gotta have your expectations pretty low, and I did enjoy this more than 5 for sure, and I only got 1 left.
What's the next one called?
That would be Police Academy Mission to Moscow. Oh, God. It doesn't even have a 7 in the title. But the thing is, up to this point, up to part 6, it was a new Police Academy every year. So, like, the first one was 84, 85, 86, 87, 88, 89. That's the first 6. Part 7's 94, so they took a 5-year break.
Didn't they? They did a TV series, too.
Yeah, there was a TV series in between, I think, 6 and 7.
Yeah, it was shot here.
Was it really?
I could take you to the Academy if you'd like to see
it. Dude, I want
to
see it. But it's what it is. I'm not going to recommend the Police Academy movies apart from part 1 to you guys. So, you know, take it for what it is. But I'm almost done. You had your doubts on me. You said I would... give up after part 1.
I'm impressed.
And I'm up to sit. I finished the first 6. So, you know.
I'm impressed.
I did it. The only other thing of note is that I had a good chuckle when the director credit came up because it's directed by Peter Boners.
Do I know that name?
He's just a guy who's directed like tons of sitcom stuff from like the 70s up.
Okay.
He directed like 93 episodes of Murphy Brown with Candace Bergen.
Oh,
remember that
show?
But he's basically, his resume is all sitcoms apart from Police Academy 6 and some movie in 1981 starring, I think, Gabe Kaplan called Nobody's Perfect.
Okay.
And that's it.
Is it plural? Boners?
It's Boner with a Z, so Boners.
Boners.
Yeah, Boners. It's new. It's hip. It's Boners, yo. Boners. You know what I'm saying?
I knew a boner once, but I've never knew any boners.
Well, now you do. So, Police Academy 6, City Under Siege.
All right. All right. Well, I'll get this one out of the way and also continue my personal series hell that I've been going through.
I haven't found Police Academy to hell, though,
okay. Well, this
to be
one
honest.
Has been kind of hell.
All right.
And that's the Ghost House Underground series that I've been
Dark Floors,
my
isn't
through.
It?
So Dark Floors,
fuck Dark Floors
was the next one.
Fuck Lordy.
And yeah, I really didn't want to watch this, but I forced myself just because I wanted to get through it.
Dude, I borrowed this off you before you watched this, and I hated it.
It's terrible. So directed, or this is from 2008, directed by Pete Riske. So this is a Finnish film.
Yeah.
So I think it was a pickup after the fact.
It was there's this Finnish metal band called Lordi.
Yeah.
Who were always kind of like compared to Gwar because they dress as monsters and
this is no Gwar.
No, they're no Gwar. They dress as monsters and stuff and they sing like hard rock, hallelujah, and all these songs like that. And this is like the basis of this movie is they're the villains of the piece.
Exactly. And their music is not threatening. It's kind of like, well, I think they won some like Eurovision.
They did, yeah.
Contest, like it sounded like American Idol or something,
or something.
I don't know what it was, but they won it, and so I mean, you can imagine that they're pretty safe, right?
Yeah.
One of them's like a mummy, and one of them's like an ox guy, and then Mr. Lordy is the singer, and he just looks like a kind of like a zombie Viking or something.
I think they were trying to make Lordy look kind of like Satan in a way, because he's got the horns on the top of his head,
right? Yeah, the big wings and stuff.
Yeah.
So this, yeah. So I was actually mildly excited about this just because I was thinking, well, if Gwar was in a movie, that would be pretty dope. So,
but Gwar has the movies they made themselves, which are kind of video movies like Skullhead Face.
True, but if they were in a feature length
movie,
yeah. But no, immediately, I knew what I was in for when there's a little girl, and I'm like, oh, fuck, here we go.
Fuck that little girl. She's the worst.
Little girl going, I want my red crayon. And I'm just like, oh, fuck.
She says it through the whole movie, doesn't she?
Yeah, she wants her fucking red crayon. And so she's like, she's like obviously autistic or got Asperger's or something.
I think she's supposed to be autistic if I recall.
Yeah, so there's something up with her. So she's in a hospital, and her dad decides to get her out of the hospital.
Well, because the hospital's shutting down.
Yeah. And but the nurse is like, no, you have to keep her here. And but no, the
it's
dad...
It's not safe to move her yet or whatever.
But the dad decides he's going to take her anyway, so he goes and grabs her, and then he goes into an elevator with the nurse and the girl and a security guard and an obnoxious guy played by William Hope, who was the obnoxious captain from Aliens that got them into all sorts of trouble. Remember that guy? He like kept making all the bad decisions, and he was kind of a coward?
Yeah.
That guy.
Okay.
So he's like an obnoxious businessman that kind of has the same... He's equally as annoying. So they go into this elevator, and then, oh, no, they go down the fucking elevator, and then, it opens up, and oh, no, they're in an alternate dimension or something.
And the thing is, dude, and I don't know if you got this from this movie, but the alternate dimension is supposed to be a figment of the autistic girl's imagination.
Or something.
Yeah, that's what I got from
it. It didn't make a lot of sense.
It didn't, but that's what it's supposed to be, I think.
Yeah, so they're in this dark... You know, dark Ooh, alternate
grimy
version.
Hallways.
Yeah, everything's dirty, Ooh. And then like one by one, the Lordy characters come out and start attacking them. So you know, the first one's like this banshee woman. I thought she looked kind of cool, but a lot of CGI. And then it's just kind of.
I think like, the ox was the worst one.
The ox, yeah.
Like, I'm gonna stew my hooves and snort and come running at you. I'm like,
I thought their costumes were actually. Sort of cool, except I didn't think Mr. Lordy looked very cool.
But
he had the lamest. So he's the singer. He's like the front man.
Yeah.
And I thought he was the lamest of them all.
I think he probably was.
Because he's in like a parking garage, and he just sort of like opens his wings and just stands there and looks threatening. But
Hard Rock Hallelujah.
But I don't know.
It's pretty awful.
Yeah, like then there's there's also like this homeless guy character who's like got some connection with the girl, of course, and he's just sort of babbling throughout.
I found the plot of this movie about clear as mud
didn't make any sense.
Nothing made
sense.
The
whole thing didn't make sense.
No.
And then the other thing is they're all like, they're in this alternate dimension, and every one of the characters is just like, no, cool, we're in an alternate dimension.
Oh my god, we're in this alternate dimension. These monsters coming at us so well.
And they're not really freaking out. No. They're just sort of like, and then the black guy has a real deep voice like this. And it's just.
And she's like, I want my red crayon. Where's my red crayon?
Yeah. And then at one point, like the dad like leaves the daughter to go off and like investigate something. And I'm like, why did he leave the daughter like alone with these strangers in this like alternate universe hell world? I don't know.
You know what I think they should have done? If they would have just given her that fucking red crayon to begin with, Lordy wouldn't have come after them.
Exactly.
Like, seriously.
Everything would have been fine. But we don't really know what happened because the whole fucking thing doesn't make
any
sense.
That's true. That's true.
So 0-3, I think.
What's
so far.
Next?
I don't know what's next. I left it as a surprise to myself.
Are you going by like release date on
DVD?
I'm
going by release date. But this is going to be a tough slog. I mean.
So what was the Brotherhood of Blood,
which was terrible.
Yep.
And then that Tattooist, which was also terrible.
Okay. There is, like I said, Dance of the Dead, I think it's called.
Dance of the Dead is coming
I enjoyed up. That one a
the
lot.
The Children is coming up.
I enjoyed The Children.
Yeah,
so
there is a few that I think two. Are going to be okay, but yeah, I'm really kind of regretting this decision.
The Children is actually one of the better Killer Kid movies of the last, like, 10 years.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. It's pretty... So I don't know what happened. Like, I'm trying to figure out, like, did... Like, I kind of thought, like, they were maybe... Like, it doesn't look like this was a production company. It looks like they just picked up movies
yeah, they're and just pickups.
Distributed them.
That's totally what it is.
Yeah, so... So I can't totally blame.
It's kind of like the After Dark. That was all pickups too. The After Dark Film Fest.
But it feels like I would have felt like Sam Raimi and Rob Taper would have had like a better handle.
I don't know how much they had like input in the actual selections, or if they just had it like one of their lackeys was like kind of.
But their name was all over it. Like
I don't know, dude.
It just feels like because like those other ones, the After Dark ones, I feel like there's a lot more good titles in those. But then again, there's a lot more movies to choose from there.
Well, yeah, there's
because
like,
they put out like 40 or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Anyway, we'll keep going.
Wow, such a glowing
dark record. Floors.
Terrible.
Don't watch.
terrible.
Unless you're a huge Lordy
fan. You would be
fan.
Better off watching a dark television set than Dark Floors.
Oh, wow. I don't know if I'd go that far. But...
Yeah, I would rather stare at a blank TV screen for an hour and a half than fucking Dark Floors. It's awful, dude. It's awful.
Yeah, it was pretty hurt.
All right, so the movie I watched that I'm going to talk about now is also not a very good movie, but...
People are all turning their
listen
podcasts
to me,
off.
Listen to me. It's fucking entertaining as
and
shit.
And we're
going to
talk about some other good movies.
This is an entertainingly bad movie. And you know what movie this is, Josh? This is 1996's Fear with Marky Mark and Reese Witherspoon.
That's not a bad movie.
It's a bad movie,
No,
dude.
No. Entertaining does not equal bad.
No.
In my book.
The reason I say it's bad is because Mark Wahlberg is terrible in it, and the plot is pretty horrible, but I fucking enjoyed the hell out of watching it. Because it's basically a flip on the crazy girl genre where it's a crazy boy.
Yeah.
So what it is Reese Witherspoon's kind of like this teenage, richy, rich girl. Her family's moved into this fancy house. Dad's played by William Peterson from CSI.
Oh, my God. I forgot about that.
Yeah. And he's like a security expert. And then she meets this Marky Wahlberg character one day at a party. And he, like, they fall in love, but it turns out that he's kind of psycho, and he's kind of, his buddies are kind of dealing drugs, and also, like, he kind of gets obsessed with her, and he gets jealous if he sees her around other guys, and he only wants her for himself, and, you know, yada, yada, plot, 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 like that. But the reason this movie is entertaining is just because of scenes more than anything.
Like roller coaster scenes.
Roller coaster finger bang. Awesome. That was filmed at the PNE.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, no.
In Vancouver here. Roller coaster finger bang. If you have seen this movie, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Nicole Forever. I'm talking four, the number, and EVA, Eva. I'm talking Marky Mark carving that in his chest, breaking a pen ink on his hand, and wiping it in to make a mock tattoo.
Oh, damn. I forgot about that.
Awesome. I'm talking... Doggy Door. I'm not going to spoil it, but I'm talking Doggy Door. I'm talking Alyssa Milano as the slutty best friend who ends up trying to fucking seduce her best friend's dad by bending over a fucking futon and showing her ass to him. Okay? This is why this movie is entertaining.
It's like all of these types of movies. They're all entertaining.
I'm talking a scene where the dad goes to confront Mark Wahlberg saying, stay away from my daughter. And he has this, the bad guy's got this whole like, not getting any at home. Look, I know about you. And he says all this rude stuff to the dad. So the dad gets all mad and flips out. I'm talking stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the problem is Mark Wahlberg is terrible in this movie.
Really?
It's just seething looks and he's just bad. He's just bad. But
him but being good bad, bad.
But him being bad is kind of entertaining. I have to admit. Though the other thing about this movie that blows my fucking mind is that it was directed by James Foley. Okay.
Wow.
This is a guy who made At Close Range in 1986 with Sean Penn and Christopher Walken, which is a great crime movie.
Yeah.
And he made Glengarry Glen Ross, for fuck's sake.
Didn't he do Wreck? He did Reckless.
I think so.
Reckless. Yeah. From 84. One of my top picks for the
90s. What's he making this?
I don't know.
It's really weird. Like, it's really weird that James Foley directed this.
No kidding.
But he's gone on, his last two movies he's directed is the two Fifty Shades of Grey sequels.
Yeah, so, he totally did Reckless, man.
So maybe Fear makes sense now to get him the gig making the 50 Shades of Grey movies.
Yeah.
You never know. But Glengarry Glen Ross is considered such, I've never seen it, but it's considered to be like one of those great 90s dramas.
It's a good movie,
And he made fucking Fear, dude, like 4 years later.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It blows my mind. I just would like to say that the first two-thirds of this movie is all that awesome stuff I was talking about with the Nicole Forever and the roller coaster finger bang and all that.
Yeah.
The last half hour is like turns into a home invasion movie where Marky Mark's character and his buddies like try and raid the house.
Yeah.
And there's like the dad, because he's in security, has this big elaborate security system. That stuff is actually quite good. Like, I'm not going to deny it. It's actually quite good. It's like fair. It's mildly suspenseful, and it takes itself a lot more seriously. So if you're into crazy girl movies and you want to see the flip of it, then definitely check out Fear, I got to say.
I'm totally going to check it out.
It's not a good movie, but if you go into it expecting it to be an entertainingly not good movie, you'll have fun.
All right. And just on a note with James Foley, so although he did do Glengarry Glen Ross, which is a great movie, although he did do Reckless, which was one of my
something you're gonna tell you made that makes sense.
He also did Who's That Girl, starring Madonna.
Oh,
so there you go.
That's like the worst.
So a very roller coaster career.
I guess so. I guess so. And now he's doing 50 Shades softcore porn for fucking Housewives.
But I haven't seen those, so those kind of like obsession movies too.
No, those are like S&M movies. That's basically a chick who gets hooks up with this guy who like fucking whips her and shit.
Yeah, but isn't it like obsession and stuff, or no?
No, I don't think so. They just are like basically like softcore erotica for like Housewives.
Okay.
It's basically the kind of shit we watched in the 90s that were directed by Gregory Hippolyte and like fucking had Shannon Tweed in them and stuff.
Right.
That's basically all it is, but on a big budgeted, big studio level.
Right.
So, Fear, check it out.
Yeah, I will. Damn straight. Okay, well,
And it is out on Blu-ray.
Okay, so I watched a movie that was coming off Netflix, as I normally do.
All right.
So I've been wanting to check this one out for a while, so I jumped on the chance. It's a movie called When Animals Dream.
Okay.
This is a 2014 Danish movie, and it's actually a werewolf movie.
I think I know of this, but I don't know anything about it.
Okay. So it's directed by Jonas Alexander Arnby, and I looked into it afterwards, and, you know, a lot of people are comparing it to Let the Right One in tone, and I can kind of see where people are getting that from, although I do think Let the Right One In is a far superior movie, and I think they're quite different movies. So this is about a young woman, like a teenage girl in Daneland, in Netherlands.
In some Danish country.
She's got this, her mom is like always in a wheelchair and all drugged up, like kind of like sedated, and her dad's taking care of her mom and her and doing his best, and she's a bit of an outcast. She eventually gets a job at a fish factory, like kind of gutting fish, and then starts to very slowly experience changes. So she starts to grow hair and so forth on her. And then, the plot sort of meanders along, and we, you know, obviously she's starting to turn into a werewolf. And then, you know, the family history starts to get revealed. And then the townspeople are, of course, afraid of her and sort of start to like want to put her into the same position as her mom so she can't do any harm. So I'm not going to really say much more than that, but I didn't really think of this. I was expecting a werewolf movie, but it was more like a coming-of-age type transformation into womanhood more than a monster movie. She does, you know, there is eventually some monster action happening, but it was it's just a quite short running time anyway. It's under 90 minutes, and it's a real slow burn. But that being said, I thought the performances were all really well done. The girl who played the lead, named Sonia Sol, was fantastic. Mads Mikkelsen's brother plays her dad, Lars Mikkelsen. I thought he was really good. The mom was really good. Like, I thought all the cast was really good. The locations were really cool. It's like a small town, kind of a small fishing village. I thought that was all really good. So I think it's worth a look if you're a fan of, like, European slow burn movies. But if you're expecting an American Werewolf in London or something, this is not what you're going
to
find.
Sounds to me more like a serious, slower Ginger Snaps in a way.
Yeah, like kind of a cross between, yeah, like Ginger Snaps and Let the Right One In, but you know, but you're pretty much following the one character, and she's not like very hip and cool or anything.
So it's kind of like a coming of age puberty movie,
kind of. Yeah,
where like she's instead of puberty, it's your werewolf surprise.
Yeah, like a transformation to womanhood. There's a bit of a love story. I think a lot of it was like a, you know, kind of a commentary on, like, you know, who are the real monsters and all that stuff. Like, I think there was a lot going on here, but I don't think this is for everyone. I think, you know, it was definitely a little slow, or like a lot slow, I should say. But I enjoyed it. But it's not a balls out werewolf movie.
But being like kind of a slow burny kind of meandering kind of story can work though, because I mean, especially in genre, because look at Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Like it's the same, sounds like it's kind of the same, like slow burny.
Or like Spring. I think I thought of Spring a bit when I heard it, but I love that movie. I didn't get this, I have the same reaction to this one.
Right.
But I still thought it was pretty good. I'm glad I watched it. Like the cover is terrible. The scenes that showed on Netflix, like when you're going through, were
was
also
the cover
terrible.
Just like a picture of like a girl with like blood around her mouth and like yellow eyes.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's how
terrible
I know,
cover.
That's how I know this, and that's why I probably didn't watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think the DVD is a similar cover.
Right.
So,
okay.
And also, I think the title's kind of shitty too. So, I mean,
what is it called?
When Animals Dream.
Yeah, that makes it sound like a indie drama or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought it was worth a look, especially if you're a fan of like European horror and kind of slower moving horror. But if you're like looking for gore and creature effects and stuff, this is not the place to come.
All right.
But it's still pretty good.
Okay. Well, I'm going to keep the unintentional hilarity of fear going. And I'm going to talk about a movie I watched, a TV movie from 1993,
ooh,
actually. It's a movie called Fatal Love on DVD.
Okay.
When it aired, it was called Something to Live For, the Alison Gert story. Now, what this is this is a true story about a girl called, well, Alison Gertz.
Really?
Played here by Molly Ringwald.
Oh, no.
And basically what happens in this movie is this was made in the early 90s, and this was at the time when you know, epidemics were happening and we didn't know much about them, but they still made movies. So basically she has a one night stand and she catches AIDS.
Fuck, I love TV movies,
and
especially
in
this era.
This is awesome. Like, she catches AIDS, but because at the time this movie is made, AIDS was still relatively new, where they didn't have all the facts out there that we have at our disposal now.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's so dated in that respect and so like misguided in certain areas. Like there's times in this movie where
I can only imagine.
There's times in this movie where, because she's like a rich girl and she's like got good family and she's not very promiscuous apparently or whatever.
How does she get AIDS?
She has a one night stand with a bartender.
Oh.
And gets AIDS from him. But it's back in the era where they're like kind of equating AIDS to being more of a homosexual disease.
Yeah.
So that's like kind of in this story a little bit. Like, it's not like really, really like obvious, but you can tell it's kind of hinted at. Like, what are you talking about? I have AIDS. I'm not promiscuous. I don't do drugs and all this stuff, right? And there's a fucking awesome scene where right after she gets AIDS, she's talking to the doctor because she gets
AIDS.
Well, she gets really sick and they can't figure out what it is, and then eventually they find out she has AIDS.
Okay.
And then the doctor's talking to her is like, well, you know, do you do drugs or whatever? And she's like, this is pretty much the exact line. She says, I don't do drugs. Well, I did cocaine once. I howled myself laughing to this scene. And it's just stuff like that. Like, there's just all this misguided, like, drama that doesn't work that just turns out to be, like, I mean, I'm sure the filmmakers had their heart in the right place, but it's just so misguided in the way it's dated and factually not up to what we know now that it just makes it, like, unintentionally funny. You know?
She seems like such a terrible choice for this.
And it's awesome, too, because, like, her friend, played by Kim Myers from Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge. She's the heroine, you know? In Freddy's Revenge, her power of love with Jesse could stop Freddy, but apparently she can't stop AIDS in this movie. But anyway, that was a bad joke. Anyway, so it's awesome because, like, when she gets the disease, her and her friend are trying to figure out, like, well, who did you sleep with and whatever? And they're like, I only slept with four guys. And she's like, what about the bartender? And then it goes to a scene of her in a club, like a 90s rave club. And she sees the bartender and he looks like fucking Fabio. So he's the long hair and it's blowing around in the fog. And then she, like, tries to pick up on him. The next scene is her in an apartment with a fire going. And she opens the door and Fabio bartender is sitting there in the doorway with his hair flowing, holding roses and a box of chocolate. And they make out in front of the fire and she gets AIDS.
But what?
It's fucking hilarious.
Why?
It's just...
Why does he give chocolates?
I don't know. It's like, if you're having a one-night stand, are you going to really bring roses and chocolates to your one-night stand?
No.
Are you just going to tear your fucking clothes off and go like bunnies?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, seriously.
There'd be no chocolates.
They tried to make it all romantic, and I'm like, why are you trying to make a one-night stand romantic?
Yeah, there's no romance in one-night stands.
No, and the whole movie's told in flashbacks because it's her going to high schools to tell her story to try and get teenagers to have safe sex.
Got it.
So it's one of those ones. So, like, it'll be, like, the beginning of the movie's her talking to the students and then the flashbacks, and then you can tell when a commercial break has been because it's back in the school with her talking and then more flashbacks and back in the school with her talking.
Where did you see this?
I bought this on DVD for $1. Best dollar I spent in the last month.
Wow.
So not only that, okay, dude, Molly Ringwald, her character in this movie is a fucking absolute bitch through the first part of this movie because she's like a rich girl who gets whatever she wants.
Right.
So she's really annoying for the first part of this movie where you're kind of like, serves you right.
Right.
It's a terrible thing because this is a real person this is based on. And, you know, she was known for like getting awareness of the disease out there. And I can't make fun of that because that was a true thing.
Yeah.
And she did die, you know, 3 or 4 months after this movie premiered. So that's fatal and terrible.
You're cold, man.
No. That's fatal. That's fatal and terrible.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's not. It's just this movie is so, way it's put together is just so silly that you can't help but be like, what the fuck? I mean, and it does get a serious tone in the last half, which actually works okay as a drama.
Right.
But dude, check this cast out. Okay. Her parents are played by Lee Grant.
Okay.
Who's an Oscar winner.
Yeah, yeah.
And Martin Landau.
Really?
Also an Oscar winner.
Wow.
And her older boyfriend is Perry King from Class of 1984.
Who's he?
He's like the older boyfriend of Molly Ringwald.
So she had a boyfriend when she banged the bartender?
Yeah. And he's an older boyfriend, and there's a
way
fucking,
older.
There's an awesome scene in this where he's like, I'll support you, baby. He's kind of like, I'll support you. Your AIDS doesn't bother me or whatever. And they get intimate with each other. And there's a scene where she catches him in the bathroom, like looking through the crack of the bathroom door, and he's fucking vigorously scrubbing his genitals.
What?
And it's so raw.
Wait, I don't understand the timeline here. How old is Perry King in this movie?
Well,
what year is this?
93.
So he had to be like 40s.
Yeah, and she's like 22.
Why is he so old? Like, why is that okay?
Because
is Martin Landau okay with this?
Yeah, they're rich people. I guess it's okay. So it's just like, I hate to rip on this movie for being hilarious, but it was.
Wow.
Because it is a serious topic, and I don't think I don't think AIDS itself should be made fun of, but
Perry King rubbing his genitals is pretty funny, though.
It is. He's vigorously scrubbing them like he's fucking put them in a vat of toxic waste or something. It's, God. Oh, it's so priceless. But, I mean, it's just, I get it. It's, you're not, the facts aren't out there as much, but, I mean, it's so cloyingly wrong-headed at times. And the sad thing about this movie is that, like, the day after I watched it, Martin Landau had passed away the night I watched this movie.
Oh, I hate that.
I hate that. And speaking of passing away, I meant to do this off the top, and I'm going to take us off topic here. I would just like to mention how devastated we are that George A. Romero left us. And I forgot to say that off the top, and I'd meant to, and his influence and everything will never be forgotten in the genre, and it was just a terrible day for me.
Yeah,
I just want to mention that really quick because I forgot to off the top. But Fatal Love, man. The only other thing I have to say about it is that...
it's not kind of a weird place to put a Romero tribute.
I know. I'm sorry. I forgot off the top. Fatal Love, directed by Tom McLaughlin, who directed Jason Lives Friday the 13th Part 6.
Oh, okay.
And has done tons
of these... He's that like cool guy director.
Yeah. He's done lots of these Lifetime type TV real story dramas, and after this one I gotta seek him out.
Wow.
I have another one at home called She's Too Young that he made for Lifetime. And what that is, it's a syphilis epidemic amongst 14-year-olds.
No.
With Marcia Gay Harden playing the mother of the main girl.
Oh my God, these dude, are awesome.
I gotta after my girlfriend and I watched this, we're like, dude, we gotta totally seek out all these 90s TV movies.
No,
these
shit
are awesome.
I know. So
like I said, subject-wise, not funny. Movie-wise, fucking hilarious at times.
Yeah, TV movies are where it's at, man.
That's Fatal Love.
Nice.
All right.
TV movies are where it's at, man. That's what I just said.
Yeah, that's why whenever a company like Shout Factory puts them out on DVD, no one buys them because they're where it's at.
No, there's some really good ones.
There are some really good ones. Like, I miss the movies of the week and stuff like that when we were growing up.
Yeah.
Like, they don't do this stuff anymore, right?
No, they don't.
Like, when we were kids, and even when we were teens, they used to have, like, two or three movies every week, like, on, like, a Thursday or a Friday night.
Yeah, and they promote like, it, like, yeah, on the, like, throughout the week. They'd be coming this Friday, you know, like, Fatal Love.
Yeah, I mean,
starring Molly Ringwald.
It'd be like, Molly Ringwald in the most shocking role you've ever seen her in yet. It's Something to Live For, the Alison Gertz story on ABC.
Yeah, I miss that.
Like, that was a time, man. Like, that was a time to be like growing up, just all these, like, even in the 70s, you know, like when we were kids, we had like the Savage Bees and Tarantula's Deadly Cargo and stuff like that, like all these sweet Killdozer.
Maybe the networks can maybe should start looking at this and making themselves relevant again.
Maybe. So yeah, Fatal Love.
All right.
Sorry for the out of place Romero tribute. It's just
we should probably do a Romero episode sometime.
We
in the near
we
future.
Probably should. Yeah. Let's plan on that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So I watched a movie that I've been wanting to see for a long time called Breaking Away.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is it's kind of a culty movie, I guess. I mean,
Yeah, probably. I'd say so.
I mean, I've always kind of thought of this as a bit of a culty movie, and, but, you know,
is this,
upon watching it, I wouldn't really say the subject matter was too culty.
This is the one with Dennis Christopher, right?
Yeah. So it's a great cast. So it's from 1979, directed by Peter Yates, who...
an awesome director.
Director Bullet and Crawl.
No, he's made some good stuff in his career.
No, he has. Great cast. So we got, it's about a group of friends, led by Dennis Christopher, of course, from Fade to Black.
Yeah, which is an amazing film if you can track it down.
Really is. Dennis Quaid, Daniel Stern, and Jackie Earle Haley.
That's a good cast.
It's a really good cast. So early roles for all these guys. I think a couple of them, it might have been their debut.
Yeah.
So of course, Dennis Quaid, we've known him from tons of movies, from Jaws 3 to
Dreamscape
to Great Balls of Fire. He's been in tons of stuff. Daniel Stern, Chud,
Home Alone,
yeah, a lot of comedy roles. Yep. And Jackie Earle Haley, of course, was in Watchmen and probably, unfortunately, most famous for lately for being Freddy Krueger in the remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. Anyway, so this is a group of friends. They all graduated from high school. They're all kind of trying to figure out what to do with their lives. The main focus is on Dennis Christopher's character, though. I wasn't expecting this. I didn't think he'd be the lead in this, but he was. And he's a bike racer. He's a cyclist who's obsessed with the Tour de France and obsessed with being French. So he goes around like the house, like speaking French and annoying his father.
Sir Dolores, would you like a baguette?
Yeah. So he's really, really into like cycling, and he wants to be French. Anyway,
does he wear a beret?
I think he does wear a beret one point.
Awesome.
But he's a really likable character. Yeah. And
he's a likable actor in general.
He is. I mean, yeah, and he's really great in Fade to Black. Yeah,
he is. Again, Fade to Black, I can't praise that movie enough.
So that's a horror movie where he is
plays like a disassociated like teenager who kind of is bullied and kind of takes
bullied
shelter.
By Mickey Rourke.
He takes shelter in film.
Yeah.
And a lot of it are just recreations of various movies that are set pieces that are like kind of murder set pieces.
Yeah,
I guess
he's a film nerd that like basically and dresses up a character.
And the reason this movie is super hard to come by, it was put out on DVD, but it's long out of print.
Yeah,
and the reason it's hard to come by is I think rights, because they have a lot of film clips in the movie. So but it's a great flick. If you can track it down, watch that for sure.
Yeah, apparently it's playing on one of the streaming services in the States.
Oh, really? Okay, worth seeing for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so we've got our guy, and he's a cyclist. And what happens is, and we're in a small town. We're in Indiana, I believe, a small town in the U.S. in the state of Indiana. And
Indiana, yeah.
No, I can't remember the
Indianapolis.
Town. No, it's not Indianapolis. That's a big town.
Oh, okay.
It's a small town.
All right, whatever.
Anyway, they do the typical things. They go swimming in a rock quarry, which is really cool, actually. And they're just sort of trying to figure out what they're doing. You know, Jackie Earle Haley's trying to figure out what he's doing with his girlfriend. Is he going to move in with her? Blah, blah, blah. But they're really likable, real-type characters. Anyway, Dennis Christopher's character is looking for a way to... do something with the cycling interest. Turns out that some of the guys that are in the Tour de France come to their town to do a race. So he, of course, joins the race, and it's pretty much about him training and sort of the ups and downs of trying to succeed.
So does he feel like if he wins this race, he'll get recognition from these Tour de France guys? Is that what it is?
I think so. And I think just recognition, I think a lot of it's from just his own father. Right. There's a lot of that stuff going on. It's a real inspirational movie, and it's a sports movie. And I know you like sports movies, as do I.
Oh, yeah. I don't play sports, but I dig watching sports movies.
Yeah. So, of course, you know, there's a big race and stuff, and it's really exciting and all that. So it's really a good movie. I mean, like I said, I've always felt this was a bit culty, because I don't know a lot of people that have seen it.
Yeah. But I've never seen it myself.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, I do. But when after watching it, I was like, no, this is pretty.
But the thing is, even if you haven't seen it, I know exactly what the movie is, and I knew what it was about before you even talked about it.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's great. There's a couple of other smaller roles. One is played by there's this kind of Dennis Christopher's character falls in love with this college girl, played by Robin Douglas. She hasn't really she had a bit of a career in the 70s, and then ended up she actually owns a bed and breakfast now, so she just sort of walked away from her career. Her boyfriend in the movie is played by Hart Bochner.
Oh yeah,
who
Hart Bochner.
He became a director, directed PCU and stuff, but he's probably most known for playing Harry Ellis in Die Hard, the bearded dick who pretty much shells out Bruce Willis.
Fuck that character.
I know. And there's also a really, really kind of blink if you miss it role from PJ Souls.
Oh, okay.
Which is pretty cool. But I'd really recommend checking this one out if you're a fan of sports movies or like kind of inspirational movies. I thought it was really good, and it's really cool seeing this cast at this age. So worth checking out. I'm glad I finally watched it.
Awesome. Well, let's keep the theme of not only sports movies going, but Jackie Earle Haley.
Oh,
because I watched 1976 as the Bad News Bears.
Okay. Yeah.
I love the Bad News Bears. Okay. So I was on vacation, and I was trying to pick some movies to watch, and I was like, you know, what's some of the movies that just say like vacation, summer to me? And I was like, Bad News Bears it is. This is coming, and we're going to watch it, and I still love this movie.
Another movie I've never seen.
I have loved this movie since I was a kid. I love it still. I had such a blast watching this a couple of weeks ago. The basis of this movie is Walter Matthau stars as Butter
What year maker, is this again?
1976.
Okay.
So he plays this like kind of drunk, down on his luck guy who's kind of forced to coach a little league team. And they're terrible. This is your typical, like, you know, group of misfits trying to take on the big dog. So he's brought in to coach these misfits in this, like, really kind of elite little league. And, you know, at first he just doesn't give a shit because, you know, he's a drunk. He's just doing this to, like, you know, because he's forced to. And he's busy, when he's not busy pulling a beer out of his cooler, not really paying attention to the kids practicing on the field. He's, like, cleaning out pools because that's his job. And he's just very disassociated from everything involving this because he doesn't want to be there.
Right.
But of course, this being the kind of movie it is, he does kind of like start to appreciate the kids because they're all like very individualistic and very like put down by everybody else, and he kind of feels that way too. So he does eventually try and make them into like a winning team, and he goes and recruits his girlfriend's daughter, played by Tatum O'Neill, because right. She's a really good pitcher and she's great in this movie. This is I think this is the first role she did after Paper Moon,
right?
Which I don't know, did she win or was she nominated?
She
for
won
an Oscar,
an Oscar, yeah.
So she won an Oscar for Paper Moon. This is pretty closely after that. And you know, and Vic Morrow plays the coach of the rival team who's just such a dick
right
through the whole movie. And it's just one of those kind of fun, you know, check your brain at the door sports comedies with kids. And when you're at the age when you saw it, I was kind of in Little League, so I was like, kind of like, yeah, this is fun. I can associate with this, right? And
so how old are the kids?
They're about, I want to say they're around 10 to 12.
Okay.
In the movie. So
is this a kids movie or is it an R-rated?
It's PG, but it's got enough stuff in it that it would probably be like PG-13.
Okay, like, or swearing and stuff?
Well, or? it's the 70s, so there's a lot of non-politically correct stuff coming from these kids' mouths. You know, there's a lot of racial slurs and swearing right. coming from these kids, especially from this kid called, this kid played by an actor called Chris Barnes.
Okay.
He was in nothing apart from the first two Bad News Bears movies and a couple TV shows. And he's this like little blonde kid who he's always lipping off everybody. And he's always like being a loudmouth and trying to get in fights with everything. And I love that kid. He's a lot of fun in this. And, you know, like I said, this is Walter Matthau's movie.
Yeah.
He is so fucking good in this because he's such a dick for the first half of this movie. Cause he's such a drunk. And then he has his moments where he's like yelling at the kids and just being a complete dick. But then by the end, he's like, you know, he comes around, but he doesn't come around in a schmaltzy way like in a lot of these movies where he's like, he's just an extreme, I'm a drunk, now I'm a happy guy who loves everyone. It's not like that.
Yeah.
It's like he's just hit the middle ground where he's kind of like, okay, I can't get out of this. I'm still going to be kind of the churlish, kind of heavy drinking guy I am, but I'm going to kind of open myself up to this a little bit. That's kind of his character in this movie, and he's great. Tatum O'Neill's really good in this too. And it's just such a fun movie. I mean,
so where's Jackie Earle Haley fit into all this?
He is one of the, he's like the rebel kid who hangs out by the baseball diamond on his dirt bike smoking cigarettes, but he's really good at playing baseball.
Oh.
So he gets recruited by the Bad News Bears and Walter Matthau to be on the team, pisses Vic Morrow's character off so badly because he hates that Jackie Earle Haley kid's guts and it was chasing him off the field. But the thing is that the Jackie Earle Haley character has the hots for the Tatum O'Neill character. So he's like, oh, if you want me to be on the team, you got to go out on a date with me and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, it's kind of that. It's like kind of the young romance kind of angle too. And you know, he's pretty fun in this too. And he's in the, I think he's only in the first sequel because there's two sequels to this. There's Bad News Bears Breaking Training, which came out the year after. And then there's Bad News Bears Go to Japan, which is pretty awful.
Is Matthau in all of them?
Matthau's only in the first one.
In the first sequel?
No, the first movie.
The first movie, okay.
Yeah, and I can't remember who it is who plays the coach in the second one, but in the third one, it's Tony Curtis, and he's pretty terrible in it.
Yeah.
And there was a TV series spun off from this show from this movie like a couple years later too that didn't last very long.
There was a TV series based on Breaking Away too.
Was there really?
Weird. Yeah.
Yeah. But I really love this movie. It's like so much fun, and it's got enough serious tones to it to kind of work on both angles. And directed by Michael Ritchie.
Oh, okay.
Who, yeah, I mentioned to you earlier. He directed one of my underrated 70s movies, Prime Cut.
Yep.
He also directed the much-loved 1985 Chevy Chase movie, Fletch, which I'm not huge on. And he made another really fun football movie called Semi-Tough in the 70s.
Yeah, he did a movie called Downhill Racer as well.
Yeah, skiing. in the late 60s. So, I mean, this guy knows how to make sports movies. He also made... of lesser note for a sports movie, we made The Scout with Brendan Fraser and Albert Brooks, which is a baseball movie as well.
Oh, he did that?
Yeah, he made that too.
That was an okay movie.
But I love the Bad News Bears, and I cannot recommend the Bad News Bears enough to people, especially people who grew up in when we did. This is a staple of my youth. I hadn't seen it in at least 15 years, and when I watched it, I still came out of it thinking, this is great, and this is probably one of my absolute favorite Walter Matthau roles of all time.
Well, I think if we ever did an underrated actors show,
Walter Matthau would be on there.
Walter
for sure.
Matthau.
He's freaking great. Because
you know what? Like, I
most
just
people just are like grumpy old men, but no.
Our generation
so
is like grumpy old man out to sea.
Yeah.
No.
No.
This guy made some really cool shit. I mean, I talked about Laughing Policeman on the underrated 70s episode. The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Charlie Varick, which is a Quentin Tarantino favorite.
Yeah.
He's been in some really cool movies. And,
yeah, he's way better than you expect. He's not a... Everyone just thinks he does these comedies because of Grumpy Old Men and that, and it's totally not.
No.
Like, that's not who he is. He's, but he's great in this, for sure. And they did remake this in 2005. Richard Linklater directed it, and Billy Bob Thornton takes Walter Matthau's role. And
oh, I forgot about that.
I did not mind it, but obviously they had to tone down some of the kids' behavior in it.
Oh, that just feels stupid.
And you know... It didn't need to be done.
No.
So it is what it is. But yeah, I can't recommend Bad News Bears enough.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, staying on the inspirational movies, I watched My Bodyguard.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the reason I'm reviewing this now is because I thought this was going to make my underrated 80s list.
Yeah.
But it did not.
The thing about My Bodyguard is, I haven't seen it in a while, but I remember there being like a couple of tonal changes in it that I'm kind of iffy on.
Okay, so here we go. So 1980, directed by Tony Bill.
Right.
He's an actor, hasn't really done a lot.
Yeah, the only other movie I know he directed is Crazy People from 1990 Dudley Moore and Daryl Hannah. That's not that great.
Yeah. So, now, this was written by Alan Ormsby.
Yep.
Jones
Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Yeah. And Shock, I think Shockwaves. And
yeah.
Anyway, kind of a horror guy. And this stars Chris Makepeace as a character named Clifford Peach.
Yep.
Makepeace, I've had a bit of a love-hate relationship with this actor. He's been in some pretty cool movies. But I don't know, something about this guy, like, it makes me want to bully him, but and I kind of do on this podcast. So sorry, Chris, but
he's kind of slight.
Yeah, and same thing. Like, he's in Vamp, which is another 80s movie I really like.
Yeah,
but again, like, it just kind of, something about him just always kind of bothers me. So again, like, I'm not too sympathetic to him pretty much right off the bat. And he starts. He's got a single dad. I don't know what happened to his mom, played by Martin Mull, who runs a hotel, and they live in the hotel, and his grandmother lives with them, played by Ruth Gordon. Holy fuck, this is annoying. Like, I don't understand, like, it was kind of that 80s comedy where you have to have, like, an old person running around, like, making, like, inappropriate jokes and stuff and being drunk.
My problem
was a trope.
My problem is that Ruth Gordon, so good in Harold and Maude.
Yeah.
And then in the 80s, she's relegated to playing the drunk old lady in this and that movie we watched, Muggsy's Girls.
The mud wrestling.
She's the mud wrestling sorority mother. And I don't get it. I don't get it either.
Yeah. But she's really unnecessary and annoying in this movie. Sorry, right. Ruth. Rest in peace. But yeah, so Chris Makepeace, he's an only child, so kind of a loner because his dad's always busy, yada, yada, yada. So he goes to new school. Pretty much right away, he starts getting bullied, probably because of his last name's Peach, but he starts getting bullied by Matt Dillon,
right?
Who plays a character named Moody. And Matt Dillon is fucking awesome in this movie. He's like a really great bully, and he's all over Chris Makepeace's character. But Chris Makepeace, he's kind of cool in that he doesn't really take shit from Matt Dillon, so he backtalks him all the time and doesn't really take a lot of shit from him.
Right.
But it does get to a point where he's pissing Matt Dillon off so much that the bullying is starting to escalate. Meanwhile, there's this kind of an elusive character around the high school named Linderman, Ricky Linderman, played by Adam Baldwin in his film debut. Adam Baldwin, of course, from Firefly and many, many other Reckless and
3:15, The Moment of Truth.
Yeah, tons. He's Hell been in yeah. tons of stuff. But he plays this character, you know, and there's like kind of legends around the school about him, like he killed his brother and he killed his mom and like all these like things, and like he's silent and he's big and everyone's kind of scared of him. And Makepeace eventually like follows Linderman home and starts a friendship with him, and eventually he gets Linderman to sort of help him get out of, stop getting bullied by Matt Dillon. And yeah.
Doesn't he basically like pay him to be his bodyguard?
He doesn't pay him. They're just friends.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought there was something to do with like him paying him. I haven't seen this in quite a while.
Yeah, no. There's no payment. Okay. I think they talk about it. He tries to pay him.
Oh, okay.
And then he says no, and then they become friends.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it's a fun little movie. I mean, I didn't hate watching it, but I just didn't. I really loved this when I was a kid, probably because I was an only child and had a bit of a shitty time in high school and in elementary school in particular. So I mean, I could kind of relate and kind of wished I had a Linderman that had my back. So I did like that part from like kind of a fantasy element, but watching it as an adult, I mean, it's still fun, but there's just not a lot there. I was reading about this movie as I was preparing for the podcast, though, and some jackass out there, sorry person, who if you're listening to this, but they fucking tried to spin this movie as an early depiction of gay characters in cinema. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
Why? Because males aren't allowed to be friends.
They're friends, and they have there's this one scene where they're on riding Linderman's motorbike together.
So what?
And like the ones on the and they're just having fun,
right?
But I guess this person has read into this that this is like an early homosexual relationship
because they ride a motorbike together.
It's like a landmark homosexual. So anyway, I did not see any of this in this movie, but anyway, it's just fucked up how just I find some people are starting to twist history around a bit and trying to fulfill their own agenda. Unless this is something I just completely missed, but even after watching it recently, I didn't get that at all from this. But did kind of bother me. Not that I really care if that was what was going on, but I just think that we're trying to read something into something that is completely not there. But overall, I mean, it's a fun little movie. I know a lot of people have fond memories of this flick, and it's still a fun little movie, but it's just not in that like best of right. the 80s. I would say it's best. This is a good example of nostalgia that maybe just it's sort of nostalgia is all that's there. Like there's just not it doesn't nostalgia does not make it a great movie.
Right. Okay.
So that's my bodyguard.
All right. So the next thing I'm going to talk about, I might as well keep on the sports bent. And I know you've watched this too, so you can chime in on this. I watched, after the Netflix show premiered, I watched Glow, Story of the Gorgeous Ladies Wrestling documentary from 2012. And now, see, Glow was a low-budget show that premiered in the mid 80s, 85, 86, I think it was. And I used to watch Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling on TV on like a Friday night after WWF's Friday night's main event. Glow used to be on, and I used to love Glow because it was like, you know, hot chicks in like skimpier clothes beating each other up and stupid slapstick jokes and stuff like that. And you know, and you know, this is the basis now of a Netflix show, which I'm gonna kind of talk about while I talk about this doc too, because I've watched the entire first season.
Oh wow, okay.
And you know, the thing about this documentary is it's only 76 minutes long.
Yeah.
And I just found that it was going way too much for drama, like personal drama, especially in the last bit, because they were talking about one of the certain girl wrestlers called Mount Fuji, and she's hospitalized at the moment, and it was mostly a focus on her going to this reunion.
I kind of like that, though.
I mean, it was, I get it. It's pretty, I get where they're going
for
it. You
need to have a story in a doc, right?
Well, I know. Yeah. I get it. But, I mean, I wanted more, a little bit more of the backstory of Glow, because I find the story to be fascinating, because it's basically, the story is, it's this guy who was a wrestling fan who had a family who had a pretty good chunk of money, and he decided, hey, I'm going to start this show about women wrestlers.
Yeah.
And he signs on Matt Simber, the director of Hundra and The Witch Who Came from the Sea, and all these kind
of... Did you know that before?
I did know that.
You did?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
And this is like...
I had no idea.
This is a guy who's made these like...
How did you know?
I just knew. I had looked into Glow in the past.
Wow.
So this is a guy who made like all these like kind of B-movies and like some softcore stuff and stuff. And he's directing this fucking women's wrestling show.
Yeah.
And it's really weird. Like, it's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
And I really wanted a little bit more of that, I feel.
Well, I think part of the problem is that Matt Simber...
Well, I know. He does show up in the finale a little bit.
And the guy who started Glow...
Didn't really want to talk.
Didn't want to be in the doc, so...
And I found that, like, I get it that you want to kind of streamline your doc to certain wrestlers and stuff. And, you know, but I found that the only one who... There's a couple who had interesting stories. Like, the girl who played Nanochka has a fairly interesting story. Ugh, because
she is so hot.
Because she's, like, she wasn't Russian, and so she was made to be...
She's amazing.
She was totally made to be, like, the communism of Russia in the 80s, right? And then there's a girl called Godiva who was, like, supposed to be, like, Lady Godiva of you know, lore, where she rode around naked on a horse, and she's British, but it was, again, she wasn't British, but she was made to put on an accent. Just stories like that about character development and all that stuff. I find that to be and more entertaining, and I didn't
get... It would have been nice to get more of that, because, like, the Nanochka character, I was really drawn to her.
Yeah.
But didn't really talk much about how she came up with the persona and like, what the reaction was. Like, you didn't really get any of that.
But that's how I can... That's how I can kind of draw this into the Netflix show, because the Netflix show is takes a lot of what they talk about in this doc and kind of gives it a semi-fictional spin, because, you know, in the Netflix show, there is a character who's being Russian.
Oh, that's okay.
Based on Nanochka and, you know, fighting for communism and all that. There's a character in it who's supposed to be kind of like Mount Fuji.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's all, like, relatable. Yeah. And, like, Mark Maron's playing the Matt Simber character in the show.
Right.
And he's fucking great in the show, by the way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found that this was a nice companion piece to the Netflix show.
Yeah.
And I feel like anyone who's gone and watched the show on Netflix should check this doc out, just to see how closely they kind of, you know, fictionalized it to enough that it wasn't, like, obvious. Like, but... If you know the history and have watched this doc, you can piece it all together, and it works.
Right.
And you know, I really like the show. I don't know if you've watched any of it.
I haven't watched it yet.
But you should check it out. It's a really fun show. It's like, Alison Brie's the main actress in it from Community and Mad Men and stuff. And you know, it's got a really good ensemble cast, but fucking dude, Mark Maron's just...
Is it going to carry on, or is it a one
season?
It's going
to continue.
Okay.
But Mark Maron is so good in it, playing the Matt Simber type character. He's so good.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a great show. And I was super stoked when I saw that it was coming on, because I was like, who the fuck remembers Glow but me?
Yeah.
And obviously it has enough of a cult following that they managed to make a TV show about it. And it stuns me to this day that...
Well, it's funny when I've talked to people at work about this, and they don't know that that is based on a real thing.
Yeah, like that's what I mean.
They think it's just this like made up thing, and it's like, no, that was a thing that was on
TV. I watched it every Friday, and live from the Riviera Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Yeah.
But Hello. It's funny how people are like, yeah. What do you mean? No, it wasn't a real thing.
Yeah, so that's like, what I'm saying. Like, I didn't love the documentary, but I totally recommend it for anyone who's going to watch that show as a companion piece to that show so that you can kind of see the parallels and be like, huh, that's really interesting. That's really cool. I want to watch clips of the actual show on YouTube, which I did after watching this documentary. So that's why I brought it up.
Oh, cool. I want to watch the show now.
Yeah,
and
you
I'm
should
glad
check
I,
the show out. It's
I'm
10
glad I watched the doc first.
It's 10 episodes. It's like 28 to 30 minutes an episode. I got through it in like a week.
Yeah.
It's a fun show. And like I said, if you watch this doc first,
yeah,
it's totally going to like make the show even more interesting because you can be like, oh, so that's where they got this from and that's where they did this from and all that. And it's really cool that way.
Nice. Cool. All right. Well,
Okay. Sorry, we're doing hand signals to each other. Don't worry about it.
Okay. So the next one I watched is another one that came off Netflix that I wanted to check out. And this is one I've been hearing about for quite a while. And finally got prodded into watching it going, oh shit, it's not going to be there anymore in 3 days.
Is that your prodding now? Is that like Netflix coming at you with like a cattle rod? Watch it.
It kind of is. It's kind of annoying. It's kind of like, well, if I don't fucking watch this now, I'm going to have to buy it.
Yeah.
So I might as well watch it and see if I like it. So I'm glad I watched this one.
Okay.
So this is called Big Bad Wolves from 2013.
Oh, is that gone now?
It is.
Son of a bitch. I meant to watch that.
You might still have a couple.
Right. I meant to watch this because this is one of those movies that Drafthouse put out on Blu-ray.
Oh, did they?
And yeah, and like on the cover of it, it's like Quentin Tarantino saying it's like one of his favorite movies of the last 5 years or something.
Okay, so this is a bit of a controversial thing here.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's sort of one thing that sort of sells this movie is that it was quote unquote Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie of 2013.
Okay.
So I decided to do a bit of digging on this, and I looked up Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies of 2013.
So it was out of context.
And this was not on the list. So I guess what happened is this screened somewhere where he was, and he said after the screening, that was the best movie of 2013. But I think he was just at a screening saying this, and then this quote then blew up. But it was not on his. It's not on his top 10 movies of 2013, because I after watching this, I was like, really?
Well,
that's your favorite, really, Quentin? Like,
well, maybe it's like we did, where we did our list at the end of the year, and then we saw stuff afterwards that would have made it like Me with the Initiation or the Invitation.
True.
Maybe that's what happened.
Maybe. Anyway, so this is an Israeli movie, I believe. Yeah, it's an Israeli movie. It's from the writers and directors of a movie called Rabies. This is their next movie.
I have that movie on DVD. I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, me too. So it's about, the movie opens with an abduction of a child. And then we cut to some men have this guy that they suspect, it's some cops, suspect this guy is the guy that abducted the child. It's this like I think he's an elementary school teacher or a high school teacher. So they have him in this like in this warehouse, and they're like beating the shit out of him, trying to make him confess to abducting the child. And he's not giving it up. Anyway, meanwhile, there's some kid like filming this all and uploads the clip onto YouTube or whatever. So we've got this police brutality case going on. So one of the lead cop that was like interrogating this guy gets basically suspended from work or fired, or I think he just gets suspended. So he needs to try and like figure out his shit and get his job back. So soon enough, they find the child dead. And, this guy that they suspected, they still kind of suspect he's the guy behind it. So what happens is the disgraced cop is sort of tracking this guy, trying to like catch him. Meanwhile, the father of the girl kidnaps the guy and like brings him to his basement and tries to like, one thing that happened when the daughter was found is that the head was missing. So he's trying to find his daughter's head so that he can bury her properly. And so the remainder of the movie is pretty much this suspect in this basement, in this remote place, with this like deranged father trying to like find out from the suspect, who may or may not be the killer, where his daughter's head is. Meanwhile, the cop is also trying to figure out what's going on so he can get his job back. So it's basically this drama between these three characters. So I mean, I kind of like, okay, so as far as like the Tarantino connection, I can see like if you're now, I know Tarantino's got a way bigger, you know, scope of film than his own films. So I don't want to just say I can see why Tarantino would like this because it's like a Tarantino film, which it kind of is. It's kind of gritty. It's got some, you know, cool characters and some violence and stuff. So I kind of get it. Crime, like Tarantino likes crime stuff. So I kind of get that. But I mean, overall, I was pretty disappointed by this, to be honest. I mean, I thought the performances were pretty good, but I mean, I thought the violence was not nearly what I was expecting. Aside from a few moments, I thought it was going to be way worse. I thought this was going to be like kind of more like a really hardcore torture movie, and it wasn't. It was, you know, it had a few moments, but overall, I thought it was kind of bland. So. Kind of disappointing. I don't think you really missed much. I mean, you're probably curious and want to see it, but you know, something's been kind of, yeah, I had real high hopes from this, but a lot of that was because of that fucking Tarantino quote.
Yeah.
And I don't know how legitimate that was. I don't know if it's just something he off the cuff said because he was excited and didn't really mean it or what happened, but yeah,
that's quite possible. Yeah, that's too bad. That's
so
too bad.
Big Bad Wolves, Israeli movie. I am the one thing I will say about it is I am curious enough to check out Rabies now. So
and Rabies is only like 80 minutes, whereas Big Bad Wolves is almost 2 hours. So.
Yeah,
you know, it's got that going for it, I guess.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple left, and both of these are theatrical watches for me. So I'll start with the one that. That I saw most recently is I went and saw The Big Sick.
Okay.
From this year, starring Kumail Nanjiani, who's a comedian. This is based on the real relationship he has with his wife, Emily Gordon, how they met. And the story is basically that he's like this New York comedian who's like trying to get a career, and he meets Emily at one of his shows, and they kind of have this like really quick, like, you know, dating, falling for each other stuff, and then she ends up like getting really sick and put in the hospital, and you know, they've just had this kind of breakup, and he goes to visit her at the hospital, and because her family doesn't live in New York, they say the only way we can save her is to put her in a medically induced coma, and he has to make the decision to do that. And then it's about him, like, you know, kind of sticking by her side and meeting the parents and dealing with this while dealing with his family, which is a traditional, you know, East Indian kind of Muslim family who want to put him in all these arranged marriages. But meanwhile, he's kind of like pining over this Emily girl. And it's kind of like a romantic comedy drama about that. And this is like the real stuff that happened.
Is it played by her?
No, she doesn't play it because she's not an actress.
Okay.
She's just like a writer producer that she works with him a lot. Like they've had, I've listened to some of the podcasts they've done in the past. They used to have this podcast about retro video gaming that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I think right now he's on that HBO show Silicon Valley. I think that's him who's in there,
yeah,
but I'm not
sure.
And that's a pretty fun show. That's from Mike Judge, who created Office Space and Beavis and Butthead and all that. But this movie was a surprise because I wasn't sure what to expect going into this, because this is like produced by Judd Apatow. And, you know, I'm kind of hesitant about Judd Apatow having his name on stuff nowadays because I find his movies to be too long.
Yeah. Was this like 5 hours long or?
No, it was just 2 hours.
Wow.
But for that's short. He didn't have anything to do with the writing or directing. He's just a producer.
Okay.
So this was, like I said, written by Nanjiani and his wife. And It has its serious moments because, you know, you have to think to yourself, well, what if you were dating this girl and, you know, you hadn't been going out for too long, but you really had feelings for her, but you were bummed that you guys had this fight and broke up, and then you have to fucking go and decide to, you know, sign the paperwork to put her in this coma.
Right.
And then have to explain that to her family. And then at the same time, you're dealing with your own family who want to disown you because you wanted basically get with a white girl.
Right.
And that's what the story is. And you know, it's a really, really good movie. Like, surprisingly good for what it is, because I was just expecting a romantic comedy when I went into it. And I got a lot more than that because he's really good in this. And I haven't really seen him in anything. And this is his first starring role, obviously. And I thought he was really good in this. He's really engaging. I thought that it's interesting, interesting to focus on the two types of culture. In the sense that, like, you know, arranged marriages just confuse the fuck out of me. Like, I don't see the point of them. And kind of the point of the movie is him saying to his parents, like, I don't see the point of this. And them kind of being like, well, too bad, you have no choice.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. That's an interesting angle, I thought, to a what's essentially a romantic comedy. Zoe Kazan played Emily, and she's really good in this, too. I haven't seen her in anything prior to this, and I thought she was really good. Her parents are played actually by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano.
Okay.
And Holly Hunter, I gotta tell you, dude, steals every fucking scene she's in.
Yeah, she always does.
Like, she is so good in this. Like, Ray Romano, I've never really been into Ray Romano. I never watched Everybody Loves Raymond or anything,
yeah.
But he's really good in this too, because Holly Hunter's character is kind of like a domineering wife, and he's kind of like this kind of meek, but he tries to act tough.
Yeah.
So he's like kind of acting tough, but he always puts his foot in his mouth, and he's kind of like all over the place. He's really good, but she's great, because there's a scene in the movie where, you know, they have this awkward moment where they're trying to bond with this Camille guy because, you know, they're mad at him because of what he did, but at the same time, they're trying to bond with him because they're in this situation together. They can't get out of it. So they go watch one of his comedy shows, and like some white frat boy yells, "Go back to ISIS,"
right,
to him while he's on stage, and Holly Hunter goes off, and it's a great fucking scene. Like, it's a really good scene, and she's just so good in this.
Right.
But I really, really liked this. Like, I really did. And the way this is going, this is going to make my end of the year list for like best movies, unless I see stuff that blows it away. And I'm really surprised by that, because I wasn't sure going in what it was going to be. Like, I saw it was getting good reviews, and I thought the trailer looked pretty good, but I was just kind of like, how good can it be? It's a romantic kind of comedy.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's really worth checking out. You know, the culture clashes stuff was really interesting. The drama was well done, and at its core, it's kind of a really sweet movie when you think about it. And it's great to see these two, Camille and his wife, getting recognition for this movie, because, you know, I had kind of known them from The Fringe, you know, like from him appearing on like podcasts I listened to and them doing podcasts together. And to see them actually be able to be successful at making this film is really cool. And I really like that. So.
Nice.
I dug this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, he does a show called The X-Files.
Yeah. There's actually jokes in this movie about The X-Files, like, because he does that show like you're talking about.
Yeah, he goes through every episode of The X-Files.
Yeah, he has a podcast where every episode's one episode of The X-Files.
Yeah.
And in this movie, they make fun of the fact that he's so into X-Files that his ringtone on his cell phone's The X-Files theme. And, you know, girls are like, you're really into The X-Files and stuff? And it's really a funny little joke for, like, people who know of his career. And I liked that, because I like to see people like him and her find this success when, you know, they're kind of coming out of nowhere, and you know, it's cool. It's really good.
So my question for you is, like, this, when I heard about this movie, I was thinking it was like a film version of Aziz Ansari's Master of None.
No,
different.
Similar in the sense that they have similar backgrounds with their families.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, in their cultures, the families all have same kind of behaviors. Kind of like in white culture, you know, a lot of parents in white culture act the same, too.
Yeah.
But in Master of None, he's never forced to be in an arranged marriage or anything like that. Like, that's not how his parents act. Because his parents...
Are cool in that, yeah.
Well, his parents in this movie are very, like, strict, kind of sticking with the religion stuff. And the religion is like, you get into an arranged marriage, so on and so forth. So
yeah,
that's the differences, really.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, cool. I really dug this movie.
No, I want to check it out. I don't know if I'll go to the theater to see it. Is it something you have to see in the theater? Or probably not.
I would say go see it because so you support the people who made it. But, you know, it's not like one that you have to... I'd say go see it if you're interested. But, I mean, it's not one of those movies that's going to be like, you know, smaller audience type movies anyway. So
yeah, cool. All right. So I went on the Arrow Video train, and
the Arrow Video train.
It stopped at a place called Wolf Guy.
What the fuck is Wolf Guy?
Wolf Guy : enraged lycanthrope. So
this sounds Asian to me.
So it's a 1975 movie.
Okay.
Directed by Kazuhiko Yamaguchi.
It is Asian. I called it.
So Kazuhiko Yamaguchi is kind of known for Sister Street Fighter.
Okay.
And he did some of the Delinquent Girl Boss movies.
Sister Street Fighter is pretty rad.
So, yes, it is. Yeah. I think, other than the original Street Fighter, it's my favorite of the Street Fighter movies. So this stars the Street Fighter himself, Sonny Chiba.
Oh, fuck yeah.
As a dude.
You know, dude, I just got to butt in here. I know you posted on Instagram about Sonny Chiba, and you're right.
I did dude post is, on Instagram.
Dude is totally underrated.
Like, what the fuck? He's rucked so, up with everyone.
Sonny Chiba is so fucking badass.
He is so awesome, and Street Fighter is like... in my Street Fighter's opinion,
awesome.
A complete classic. Yeah,
Street Fighter's
awesome.
And
it's not even on a fucking Blu-ray.
No, it's just...
Yet because Arrow is putting out Wolf Guy.
The problem
I don't understand.
The problem is with Street Fighters, I think the rights are got to be so muddy on that because there's so many like public domain knockoff DVDs out there and stuff.
Yeah, but if it's public domain, you should be able to put it out no problem.
Well, you know who's good at taking public domain titles and making them really good on Blu-ray is Severin.
Okay.
So maybe they need to snatch up some Street Fighter and give us the Sonny Chiba love that we all deserve.
Yeah, in the extremely unlikely world
hey, Severin,
where
are you listening?
Someone who knows one of these companies is listening.
Hey, dude, but this please. Happens. This happens. What happened after our last episode?
I
put the hidden on it. It got announced on
it
Blu-ray.
It has happened a few times.
It's happened four or five times that we've talked about a movie wanting to be on Blu-ray, and it's happened.
But you're right. I watched this, and I was thinking of Sonny Chiba, and I was like totally shocked that Street Fighter
does
not
have a proper fucking movie.
Yeah, it's rad.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to this one.
Okay.
So,
I'm assuming it's better than Wolf Cop right off the bat.
I haven't seen Wolf Cop, okay, but either I would assume it's better.
Either of us.
Yes. So it opens with this guy being like chased down in like the streets of Tokyo or running through the streets of Tokyo, and he's obviously scared, and he thinks he's being chased by a tiger. So Sonny Chiba, like, he's kind of he's a reporter. So he's like there and sort of seeing this guy in the middle of the street, like freaking out about this tiger. So, then everyone's just sort of like, well, whatever, man. So the guy like runs down an alley, and Chiba goes after him and sees the guy actually get slashed apart
really?
By an invisible force. And it like, yeah. So you like see the guy's like, you know, clothes ripping and then like marks.
It's kind of like early Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, where you see the cuts
exactly. And really gory, like really gory.
Right.
Like, I mean, depending on how you look, like we're talking like Shogun Assassin style gore,
okay.
Like with like a cut and then a big spray of blood,
right? Right.
Like Kill Bill, right? Okay. So I was like, kind of like, holy fuck, right? Like, what's going on? So it turns out that there was this. So Chiba's a reporter who starts investigating. Turns out that there was this. Okay, it's a little complicated, but there was this woman named Mika, who was like gonna marry this rich dude, and I think what happened is the rich dude's dad didn't want his son to marry this woman. She's a singer, so he this is fucked up. Okay, so he got this band called the Mods, like a rock band, to gang rape her. And give her syphilis.
What?
And then get her hooked on heroin. So she was unappealing to...
Because all rock bands are rapist heroin fiends.
Yeah, this would make her unappealing to the rich guy's son.
Did Tom McLaughlin direct this?
I told you you directed this.
I know.
So that made her...
Sounds like a fucking Lifetime TV movie.
No, so that made... Yeah, exactly. So that made her unappealing because she now had syphilis and was a drug addict. So the rich son got out of Dodge. So what it also did, though, is it fucked her up in the head and kind of, I think, got her possessed with this, like, weird tiger power or something.
You're making a lot of sense right now.
The movie doesn't make any sense.
Syphilis and heroin causes the tiger spirit to take over your soul.
That's what happened. I'm just telling you what happened.
All right.
Okay, so then...
It's a 70s Asian movie. It's okay. That's what most of them are like.
So then, you know, like, Chiba's, like, you know, starts to get involved in all this. And I gotta say, man, okay, so there, he has some fight scenes in this that are pretty good. He is a fucking stud, man. This guy is so cool. And, like, every woman that comes near him is just, like... fucking wet. He's
fucking panty repellent is what he is.
They are just going fucking crazy. Like, they are sliding on the ground as they walk.
Like, he walks into a room and it's like there's a swimming pool.
And he's just like, he is so cool. Like, the tiger syphilis girl, she's like, you won't love me because I have syphilis. And she's like totally into him. And he's such a stud. He's about to fucking fuck her. He doesn't care if she has syphilis. He's going to fuck her anyway, because that's just the kind of guy he is.
Dude, all I picture is fucking women sliding across the floor now. Thanks a lot.
Sorry, that was pretty crass, but I just really wanted people to get the point as just to, like, how awesome he was.
Holy fuck. I can't get that image out of my head now.
Yeah, he was a stud. So... So, anyway,
I would not want to be the maid after that.
So, I don't know what happened next, but somehow he is, like, captured, and they, like, they do surgery on him. Like, they do surgery on him while he's tied up and awake. But then this is where the lycanthrope thing comes in, because it was revealed that when the moon is full, he... has, like, superpowers. So he can, like, heal himself and shit. So, like, they do surgery on him. So, like, there's a shot where he's, like, lying on the table and his intestines are all hanging out.
Yep.
But the moon shines on him and his intestines all go back
inside. That's awesome.
It's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
And then the movie kind of ends up, like, at this, like, kind of rock quarry, and there's a big fight scene there. And, yeah, it's just... But, yeah, this does not make any fucking sense. And it's called Wolf Guy Enraged Lycanthrope. There's no werewolf transformation.
Really?
He never turns into a werewolf.
But you didn't even mention werewolves. You mentioned a fucking tiger.
He's got these werewolf powers.
Oh, okay.
That's why the full moon, like, heals him.
Okay.
So now it's got this score that's, like, total, like, waka 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 funky music,
right?
And it's so fucking rad.
So it's like 70s blaxploitation music.
It's
almost
like 70s blaxploitation in a Japanese weird kung fu movie. I don't even know what else to say about this. If you're a Chiba fan, this is totally worth checking out. I can't believe...
If you're not a Chiba fan, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Exactly. I can't believe that Arrow put this out. Like, this is what I love about Arrow. And, you know, a lot of these companies right now are putting out, you know, I mean, we're getting a lot. It's a great time to be a collector. We're getting a lot of cool stuff, you know. But, you know, we do get a lot of the sort of standard fare that we've seen a million times.
Which, like, we were talking.
The Hills Have Eyes. And,
yeah, we were talking about this earlier. We were talking about the... San Diego Comic-Con
Screen Factory
announcements and how weak they are.
Yeah, and, like, Reanimator is coming out from, like, and Arrow's doing that, but, like, Reanimator is coming out for, like, the 20th time.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's when they put shit out like this, where I'm just like...
Well, this and that Hired to Kill that you talked about.
Hired to Kill I loved as well. But I didn't even know this movie existed.
Right.
And then Arrow puts it out. I'm like, okay, I'll check that out. And, wow, it was just... Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Not the greatest movie, but as a spectacle and as a vehicle for Chiba, this is pretty cool shit. All right. So really dug it. And tons of nudity, tons of gore. So if you're a fan of that stuff, it's really over the top. But yeah, if you're looking for a plot, this isn't the place. But if you're looking for like kind of an exploitation 70s Japanese movie, this one's crazy, starring Sonny Chiba.
Let me just say that if you're looking for plot in a 70s Japanese movie, you're going to be sadly mistaken on this type of flick most of the time anyway.
Well, there is, like, if you're going for a martial arts flick, yeah, time it's going to be kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
But this was really good. So yeah, it's called Wolf Guy.
Awesome. So I'm going to do my last one is my second theatrical experience that I had in the past couple of weeks, and I went and saw the new Edgar Wright Jam, Baby Driver.
Right.
And again, I really liked it.
I really hate that title.
It isn't a very good title.
An awful.
The reason
title.
It's called that though is because the main character played by Ansel Elgort is called Baby.
I don't care. That's not. It's
I know.
Not a
I
good
know.
Title.
That's the thing, right? The title
makes me not want to see the movie.
You should, though, dude.
I know, but it makes me not want to.
Okay, so basically this... I know. The story of this movie is that Baby, played by Ansel Elgort, is like a really awesome getaway driver. And but he has... so he's hired... He does jobs like bank robberies. He's the getaway driver for bank robberies that are set up by a businessman played by Kevin Spacey.
Okay.
And the basics of the movie is that he has tinnitus, which is the ringing of the ears from, you know, an accident he suffered as a child. So now he just listens to his iPod all the time to drown it out. And it's got like, you know, when he's driving away from these robberies, he's listening to his iPod, and the actual car chase scenes are set to the music he's listening to, and they're staged to go along with the beats of the song. And that's really cool.
Okay.
Like, really cool. And basically what it is he's working for Kevin Spacey to pay off a debt that he owes him, and that once he's done paying off the debt, he's going to, you know, get out of the game, because he kind of meets this waitress in this greasy spoon diner and, like, falls for her, and they want to, like, kind of pursue this relationship, but he can't right now because he's driving these robbery things, and Kevin Spacey's not letting him get out. And then at the same time, there's side characters played by Jamie Foxx and John Hamm, who are like robbers that he drives a lot of the time around. And, you know, it's basically just a car chase movie with bank robberies with a little side of romance. And you can totally see where Edgar Wright gets his influence in this movie. It's mostly Walter Hill's The Driver, to be honest.
I've never seen that.
So if you dig The Driver, which I do, it's really worth watching. What's really cool about this movie is that when Edgar Wright wrote it, he wrote it to kind of like go along with certain songs. So he'd
What's
pick
the driver about?
The driver, it's about a getaway driver, basically, played by Ryan O'Neill.
So what's the plot?
Well, I don't want to spoil it for you, and I haven't seen it for quite a while, but it's a great movie. Lots of car chases.
Okay.
So it's kind of similar to this, like kind of like he's a getaway driver and needs to get out of the game. It's kind of similar in that way. You put me on the spot here. But
said you loved it. I'm curious.
I do, but I haven't seen it in a while. I loved it when I saw it.
Okay.
So this movie opens with a frigging awesome car chase, followed by a title sequence, which is kind of like a dance number in a way, because it's Baby going down the street listening to a song and like kind of getting into it. And the coolest thing about that is the production design is he'll be walking along and there's spray paint on the walls that match the lyrics of the song he's listening to. And there's all these like subtle lyrics. Like if you're looking for them, you can see them. And that's really cool production design. I love it when people do creative shit like that in movies. Like I find that to be really fascinating and fun.
Yeah.
So I really dug that. And there's about three or four car chases in this movie that are really good. Like really good, like top notch car chases. The way he's matched up the soundtrack to all the action sequences is great. It works perfectly. You're going to be happy to know that there's a fucking Focus song on the soundtrack.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Focus?
Yeah, the one with the yodeling, dude.
Yeah.
Fucking awesome. Nice. Best moment.
All right.
John Hamm is great because he's like kind of a sleazy bank robber type. Jamie Foxx is fucking awesome in this. And I hate I don't think I've ever said fucking awesome about Jamie Foxx before in my life.
No.
But he's so good in this because he's like kind of like a psychopath, kind of like sarcastic guy. There's a great scene in this involving Mike Myers masks.
Okay.
Which is in the trailer, so it's not spoiling anything, but it's a great scene. It's just a lot of pulp culture references, witticisms, references to other movies, great songs on the soundtrack, great car chases. It's just a fun movie. It's not a movie that you have to think much about when you're watching it, but if you like Edgar Wright's other movies like Scott Pilgrim, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, you'll like this.
Okay.
Like, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Granted, you're right, not a very good title.
No, worst title of the year.
Like, not a very good title. It's great to see Kevin Spacey because I don't see him in much because I don't watch House of Cards.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I haven't seen him in much movies-wise. Really good in this. Like, yeah. He is all the time. And, you know, if you're into, like, kind of a fusion of action comedy with a really kick-ass soundtrack and you really dig, like, the car chases, and I'm not talking, like, Nicolas Cage Gone in 60-Second Car Chases. I'm talking, like, original Gone in 60-Second Car Chases and, like, fucking Bullet and shit like that, like French Connection, like good car chases,
yeah,
then you should see this flick.
Okay.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if I can get past the title, man.
Dude, just fucking, you do the same thing with Get Out. You're like, I don't know if I can get past that trailer, man. Just,
it's true. I still haven't seen Get Out because of that fucking trailer.
Just watch it, dude.
That fucking poster.
Just watch it. Awful. Just watch it. It's really fun. Trust me.
All right. Yeah.
Josh's VHS Adventures.
Yep. That's that time of the month.
Time of the month?
It's that time of the episode.
You have syphilis.
No.
Is it your period? Are you sliding along the floor?
I'm sorry. That was totally fucking offside.
But dude.
But it painted the picture.
And painted the floors, apparently.
That I needed to paint.
All right. What do you got for us this week on your...
I have a movie directed by Joseph L. Scanlon.
Okay. And is it, let me guess. Spring Fever.
Oh my god, how do you know?
Fuck yeah. Co-starring Carling Bassett, Canada's tennis
how
sweetheart.
How the fuck did you know that?
Because I have a lot of useless information in my head.
Wow.
You're welcome. Okay. Isn't this the one that you had that has tape rot?
It is.
And you managed to watch it?
I did not watch the tape.
Oh, okay.
But I do want to get rid of the tape.
All right.
So, yes, the tape... The tape has tape rot. So if you don't know what tape rot is,
yep.
It's this horrible thing.
For all
thing.
You people who don't know what VHS is.
Yeah, when you have VHS collection, it's this horrible thing that happens, especially when you buy tapes from Value Village. Sorry, Value Village. But sometimes you'll buy a tape and it will have like white mold all over it.
Yeah, it's just because of moisture getting in the casing mostly.
Yeah, so if you play that in your machine, it will wreck your machine.
Yeah.
So I had to find another way to watch this, but I did. So, yes, and also, so it's called Spring Fever. It's from 1982.
I saw this when I was a kid, and I hated it, just so you know.
So the reason Chris hated this movie is because the fucking
It's called
cover,
Spring Fever, and it looks like a fucking TNA movie.
Yeah, so the cover has two, like, bikini chicks holding this dude
There's
upside
no bikinis
down.
In this movie.
And they're pouring beer on his cock.
Well, his cock?
Like between his legs. On his
this
ball.
Is,
on
this,
his,
does, this doesn't happen in the movie at
on
all.
On his balls.
Okay.
And so it's like,
is he sliding across the floor from the beer?
This is a crazy spring break movie where there's going to be beer and drinking and bikinis and nudity and stupid jokes and
nope.
swearing.
Nope.
And, nope.
It's
nope.
a PG-rated tennis movie. Fuck
that
you,
is
Joseph.
Not
Stanley.
What happens. Yes, Chris is correct. This is a movie about a tennis championship.
Yeah,
and an unlikely friendship between a young girl played by, as Chris said, Carling Bassett,
Canada's tennis sweetheart.
Yeah, who was a big tennis star. She was also the her. I think her mom is the. Ran Carling Brewery. That was a big brewery up in Canada.
Could be.
And her dad was like a TV mogul up here in the Great White North. And yeah, she was a tennis star.
Yeah.
And she's a teenager in this, or very young, like I probably around 13, 14,
probably,
I'd say.
Yeah.
And she stars in this, and it's about her at this tennis championship in Florida, and she... yeah, it's just kind of, she's kind of the oddball, and her mom's played by Susan Anton, who's a Vegas showgirl who is very, very hot. I've always had a thing for Susan Anton. I don't even know why, because I don't even remember seeing her in anything. I guess I just remember, she was in this movie called Golden Girl. You heard that?
Yeah.
Where she was like this like Olympic athlete who was like super trained.
I think that's a TV movie.
No, I think it's a real movie.
Is it? I thought it was a TV movie. Maybe not. Okay.
But the main thing I remember with Susan Anton is just she had a thing with Dudley Moore. And I just remember seeing photos of the two of them.
She's like super tall.
And she's like this super hot, like statuesque model like girl. And then Dudley Moore, who like came up to her, his like top of his head was at her tits.
Perfect level.
And it just looked hilarious.
Perfect level.
So that's what I remember. But yeah, Susan Anton plays the mom and she's gorgeous in this as well. And but she's kind of a flake. And so Carling Bass is, you know, struggling because her mom's kind of a flake and attracting all this attention. And, you know, she's like kind of like, yeah, she doesn't really fit in. And like the other girls don't really like her. But eventually she ends up forming a bit of a friendship with the kind of champion girl who's this like rich, really rich kind of spoiled girl who doesn't really want to. She's one of those ones that where she's been kind of forced into being the champion and she just wants to be a normal girl, you know, that thing. So it's
this
like,
sounds like a fucking drag.
The two of them form this unlikely friendship. Now they do. There is a montage sequence to this where they go and have a day together.
Okay.
And I'm telling you, man, fucking Ferris Bueller would be jealous. Like these two, they go everywhere
in one day.
Oh yeah, they go to the amusement park, they go to the zoo, they feed dolphins, they like hang out with a band. Yeah, it's super.
Like, is there nobody out that day? Because that would never happen these days. They'd be in line for fucking 4 hours to get on a ride at the amusement park.
They're just out, they go around, and like it's seriously every
I guess when you're a tennis star you get fucking perks
maybe, but it looks like they are just having the time of their lives. They drink drinks together with two straws in the same drink. Now if that person who fucking watched My Bodyguard watched this,
you know,
I'm
what?
Sure this would be a this early is, lesbian this
is, it totally is, dude. Totally is. Those straws were symbolism.
Yeah, I know.
They were symbolism for the fallopian tube.
I think this would be a great double feature because obviously these are the first two gay movies that ever came out.
They came out like this around the same time. My Bodyguard was 80 and Spring Fever was 81.
No. So anyway,
these were ahead of their times.
I did not read that into this either. So yeah, and we're totally like joking about that. But it was a
did
pretty
they
epic
share
day.
Milkshake?
They shared some sort of drink. They both had straws going
I bet
into
you
the
it was
same
a fucking milkshake.
I kind of thought it looked more like a fruity drink, like maybe a, you know, like
fruity. That leads to the lesbian theme.
Oh my god. Anyway, now another thing after their fun day,
after their date.
No, it's not a date. And they play.
Okay. If it's a montage, though.
They get to feed dolphins. Okay, dude. It's so fun. They go on the roller coaster. Like, I was so fucking jealous. I wish you and I could go have a day like this.
Really?
It would be so fun.
You want to have a day like this?
It would. It just can't happen, but it would be a real, real
It would be kind of creepy if we went to fucking the petting zoo and the roller coasters. What are those fucking 40-year-old men doing sharing a fucking drink?
Well, I guess I always just picture myself as 12 still. So.
Yeah. But, okay, is there a really sweet, like, 80s song playing when this montage is going on?
What was the song?
We're the best of friends.
Yeah, I'm sure there was. I know Hit Me with Your Best Shot plays a couple times.
Does it play while they're playing tennis? Because that would be awesome.
No, it's the opening scene. Well, she's the
is she hitting tennis balls?
The opening scene is her kind of hustling this older guy.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of a creepy scene actually, but she's like, you know, playing this older guy for money, and
right.
Then Hit Me With Your Best Shots playing, and then she hits the ball and hits him in the balls.
Oh, yeah.
We also get this song, Turn Me Loose from Loverboy.
Turn me loose.
That's in a...
do it my way.
In a party scene.
Nice.
Nothing
gets the ladies wetter than Sonny Sheba than fucking Loverboy. I don't know. It just felt like
it's Mike Reno's headband.
Must be, or the fact that when he sings, he looks like he has to take a shit.
Does he?
He always. He's got that grimace on his face when he sings. Watch the videos.
Loverboy were world famous, right?
Huh? Yeah, they were.
They were the Vancouver band.
I know.
Yeah.
Mike Greeno, you can go visit his house. I think he lives in West Van.
Does he?
I think so.
Oh, maybe we should get him on the show.
Dude, let's get Mike Greeno on. We'll be like, dude, were you able to have children with those fucking hot, tight leather red pants you wore in the 80s?
Like, Has he done anything film related?
I don't think so, but Loverboy put out an album in 2008.
So after the like cool like fun montage sequence,
yep,
the movie gets kind of dark because
why does the mom beat her?
No, because it actually gets really dark. I'm gonna spoil a few things here.
Anyone's gonna track down Spring Fever. It's probably not gone past VHS for fuck's sake.
They might. It has not gone past VHS. Yeah, correct.
Exactly.
So Missy, she's got this like,
who's Missy?
Missy's the like rich like tennis star. Okay. So she like they're out in a limo together, and they're with this like other
limo
woman.
Driver molests her.
No, she's an older woman that's with them. I'd say she's around 18.
Okay,
wearing a headband, so she knows she's bad news. But she's like kind of this.
But
wild,
all tennis players wear headbands.
No, she's not a tennis player. Oh, okay, she's like this wildcat. I think she's like a caregiver or something, like a caretaker. 18? I guess so. Like kind of like a babysitter, maybe.
All right, okay.
I don't know. Anyway, for whatever, she's also a fucking cokehead.
Oh,
so
it's the 80s.
For
makes
whatever
sense.
Reason, they stop at this club, and the cokehead goes into the club and drags Missy with her. Mm. So Missy goes into the club with her, and the girl's like trying to score some blow. And then the cops come in and they chase down Missy and this woman, and Missy gets arrested. And then she fucking throws KC, Carly Bassett, under the bus. So there's all this drama about that.
Bitch.
Total bitch. So then they're like having their like final tennis match, and her fucking Missy's dad has a fucking heart attack. So she's
fucking hell.
It gets super dark. So she has to play through that. And meanwhile, Casey's like feeling betrayed, but also trying to support her friend. And anyway, making this sound way more exciting than
it
was.
And at the same time, here's Josh sitting in his living room watching this going, where's the fucking guy getting the beer poured on his dick? I need to see that.
I knew right away. I knew within 10 minutes, especially when Susan Anton showed up. I'm like, okay, there's no way there's going to be any action in this movie with Susan Anton, even though she's super hot. But she's like banging Dudley Moore. So like, I mean, how hot can this get? But sorry, Dud. I thought for like a silly little like, you know, drama comedy teenage movie, thought it was all right. I didn't think this was terrible. I thought there were a few things about it, like Susan Anton's character like falls for this like reporter guy, and he's older and kind of British, and like I'm just like, no way, dude. There's no way that this fox is gonna go for that dude. So you know, stuff like that kind of bothers me when that happens. But overall, I really liked Carling Bassett. I thought she was great. This is, I think, she didn't really do much acting-wise because she was a tennis star.
I think this was maybe her only movie.
But she was really likable in this. I really dug her character. I thought the girl who played Missy was really good, too. This was her only movie as well. This was a Canadian movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen this since it first came out. I saw it on TV, and I didn't like it. Exactly, because I thought it was going to be a sex comedy.
Yeah, this was hardcore false advertising on the cover. Like, maybe one of the worst I've ever seen as far as, like, the promise that's given that is completely not.
You're promised beer poured on a cock and you get tennis and fucking sharing a drink. This is not what you signed up for.
It is not even close to what that cover makes you think you're going to get. So I was expecting like Hot Moves or like Spring Break or something, one of those movies. No, that was not what this was. This was like,
it's kind of like an episode of Silver Spoons or
something. It was nice. It was a nice movie, but it was a TV movie almost.
Right.
But anyway, there you go. Spring Fever.
Josh's VHS Adventures. All right. Well, let's talk about some summer camp movies. And The thing is we had decided to do this as a top five. I had picked five. Josh was like, I can't think of any more than three.
No, I've thought of a lot.
But he's only seen three, apparently.
I have not seen... Okay, first of all, I want to just talk about, have you gone to summer camp?
Yes.
Okay, so that might be a fundamental difference. I went to summer camp. I lied. I did not go to summer camp. I went to Cub Camp.
Okay, that's different.
And I was a fucking bedwetter, and it was horrible.
Okay.
And I remember this guy in my cabin told everyone,
okay,
that I peed in my sleeping bag.
But did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was fucked up, and it was horrible. I hated it.
Okay.
Look, this is real deep stuff, but man.
Dude, on that note... Listen to this shit.
Did you pee the bed?
Yes. Listen to this. I went to summer camp. It was put on through my school. I went to summer camp. This is like 1980. This was when I was like 11, I think. I went to summer camp. I was in a cabin. Everyone was fucking around. They took our flashlights away. Middle of the night, I have to pee so bad, but I'm as scared of going out in the fucking woods in the dark because I had seen Friday the 13th. Nobody would give me a flashlight because we had one flashlight between the whole cabin because they took all the rest away. No one would give it to me, so I pissed myself.
Why wouldn't anyone give it to you?
Because they were fucking assholes because children are assholes.
Wow.
Summer camp sucked.
Yeah.
The only thing I remember liking about summer camp is the fact that somebody from before left behind a cassette of Ozzy Osbourne's The Ultimate Sin album, and I found it wedged between my mattress. I was like, fuck yes, Ozzy. That was the only good thing about summer camp. They had the fucking talent show at the end, which I fucking didn't want to take part in because I had
social anxiety. Oh, really? You had a talent show?
Dude.
Why do they make you do shit like that?
I don't know.
You do shit like that when you're an adult, even.
I think it's like...
Fuck that shit.
I think they think it's like character building. It's like, fuck character building. I'm a grown fucking person. I'm a miserable fucking person. Just let me be fucking miserable and watch my movies and get the fuck out of my face. That's all there is to it. Let me piss myself and get the fuck away from me. You know, like, come on. Like, seriously.
So the thing with summer camp movies...
I think I live vicariously through summer camp movies because my summer camp experience sucked.
And I think that's the thing. Like, I think for me, I've always kind of thought, like, whenever I hear of a summer camp movie, I'm like, oh, cool. I wouldn't mind checking that out. But I think whenever I
summer camp sucks.
When I actually go to, like, actually watch it, I'm like, this fucking haunting comes over me. And I'm like, wait a second. And it's like I'm repelled by the movie. Like, I physically cannot hit play on the summer camp movie. And, like, it's only recently that I've come over out of this.
Right.
Because, as you know, I have watched some of the Friday the 13th movies.
Right.
And some of the I watched all the Sleepaway Camp movies.
Yeah.
That's only in the last couple of years, dude. Like, before that, I was like, it was like fucking kryptonite to me. Like, I would like go to like put a summer camp movie on, and it was like garlic. I would go jump back hissing. And it's also like the sun for me. I just don't like summer, really. I'm not a big fan.
Well, you were a goth in high school. Josh.
No, I still am not a big fan of summer. I don't like the heat. I don't like being all fucking hot and sweaty and gross. I don't like not being able to sleep. I don't really like the outdoors, you know? So I just, you know, I don't know. I mean, yeah, maybe in a fantasy world, I like to see people jumping around in their short shorts in the 70s. Sure, I'm cool with that. But I don't know. Overall, like, it's just not a genre I'm drawn to.
Well, you know, Josh. You know what? Apart from the sun, makes people hot and sweaty. Sunny Chivas.
Only the ladies.
So, yeah, I get where you're coming from, but like for me, because like I really, really was excited to go to summer camp, and I really wanted it to be fun.
Really, it was like horrifying.
No, like I wanted to go. I thought because you know I was like, oh, this should be fun. This will be cool. And then like to be there and like be the second night you're there, have this like fucking traumatic experience.
Yeah,
and you're like, I fucking hate summer camp, right? But then I'm like, I think from there,
I know this. I even remember the fucker's name that outed me on the fucking peeing thing.
Yeah.
Mark. His name was Mark.
Do you know his last name?
I don't remember.
Totally Facebook stalk his ass. It'd be fucking awesome.
But he like ruined my life. Like, He ruined summer camps for me, that fucker.
Well, that's the thing, like...
And he wasn't even, like, he... Fuck him. Fuck that guy.
That's the thing, that kids are assholes, right?
He was a total asshole.
So I'm like, I'm in my cabin, and I'm fucking dancing around. I'm like, I gotta pee. Give me a flashlight. Give me a flashlight. No one gives me a flashlight. So I'm like, I can't wait. I can't go out in the dark. I'm scared. Blah, blah, blah. And then everyone's like, oh, yeah, fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, come
so
on.
So did you have it, like, the whole, like, pants getting darker
Dude,
thing?
Yes.
Oh, that's the worst. It's
terrible.
I did that in elementary yes. school once.
Now everyone knows we pissed our pants, so they're going to stop listening to us.
Fucking good thing David Hess isn't with us anymore.
Piss your pants. Piss your pants. If he did that to me at summer camp, he'd be good to go, man. He wouldn't have any issues. He wouldn't have to carve his name in my chest because I'd be following his wishes. It'd just be the way it was. Could you imagine David Hess as a fucking summer camp counselor? That'd be the worst.
Oh my god.
You'd be good at knife throwing and shit.
Here's your counselor, Krug.
Here's Counselor Krug. I'm going to show you kids how to knife throw. Then we're going to do a little carving. Not fucking wood carving. Just be ready.
That would be an awesome movie.
Krug Camp. Oh fuck! It's too
Can't
bad.
Doing the thing I hate. I'm like laughing at myself on a podcast.
It's okay. Too bad that David isn't here with us. We could pitch Krug Camp to him. He'd be down with it. I think.
I was gonna pitch a movie to Dave. I met him once, and yeah. I was gonna pitch a movie where like two crazed fans like abducted him and yeah. made him piss his pants.
That's awesome. Piss your pants.
I wish we did that. That would have been hilarious.
All right. So anyway. So how do you want to do this part? Because I have five titles written down.
Well, whatever, man. I mean, we can go through your five. I can talk about some of them. Then I've got other ones okay. that you didn't write so, down. We can talk
so
about.
So the five I wrote down are the ones that for me defined summer camp movies, because I like summer camp movies, even though I hated summer camp. So the first one that I wrote down is because you cannot talk about summer camp movies without talking about this movie, and I started the episode singing a song from this movie. It's Meatballs from 1979.
Right.
Directed by Ivan Reitman, starring Bill Murray.
Yeah. And my
This captures the spirit
my buddy
of how
Chris.
Huh?
My buddy Chris yes. Make Peace.
So this captures the spirit of how I always thought summer camp would be, and it wasn't. So this was like getting my hopes up before crashing me down into a fucking pit of misery.
So did you see this before you...
I did.
Oh.
And that's why I was like, oh, summer camp's going to be awesome. They prank the fucking camp head. You know, there's a guy called Spaz there who's always trying to get the girls, but he's a fucking freak and he can't get anyone. And they do all this fun shit. And there's these cool counselors there. So even if you're like an outcast, they build you up and make you awesome. And I used to think that was how it was going to be. And I didn't think I'd be sitting in the middle of the fucking dark at 2 a.m. pissing myself, clutching an Ozzy Osbourne tape.
Wait, I just want to go back to that night, the fateful night.
My so fateful night?
What happened after that, though? Like, were you stuck at the summer camp for like another week?
Oh, yeah, fuck. Dude. It was like another like 4 or 5 days after that.
So how did that go?
Terribly.
Oh my god!
Terribly.
My dad was with me at the summer camp
when you did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's you know, at least then your dad probably wasn't like, well, that's okay, son. You know, he probably wasn't like a dick about it or anything.
No, he was cool.
But kids are dicks, so you know it's remorseless, like taunt, relentless,
yeah.
relentless.
Yeah.
So you know, Meatballs is a fun movie. Like, you know, it's co-written by Harold Ramis, Len Blum, and Dan Goldberg. These guys did Stripes after this, which, you know, is a lot of people think is one of Bill Murray's best movies. I dig Stripes, but I, you know, it's not my favorite Bill Murray movie.
Can I just go off for a sec?
Yeah.
Did you hear that they're going to be doing another Ghostbusters movie?
Like with girls?
Okay. So I heard they're going to be doing a new Ghostbusters
okay.
movie, and they're going to fucking take the old Ghostbusters.
Okay.
So Aykroyd, Murray.
Right.
Mix them with the new Ghostbusters.
The girls.
And they're going to bring Harold Ramis back as a CGI character.
Fuck that.
I know, right?
Yeah, like the fucking girls Ghostbusters movie was a success. Fuck
Isn't that crazy?
That's so stupid.
Ivan Reitman apparently let this loose at Comic-Con.
That is the dumbest shit I've
Can
ever heard.
Can you imagine?
No. Like,
I just think that's so disrespectful.
It is. I mean, like, it's disrespectful not only to Harold Ramis, it's disrespectful to fans of the original Ghostbusters movie.
Yeah.
Like, fuck that shit.
I just don't want to see. This is what I was worried about when Star Wars right. came out and the whole Peter Cushing thing. I don't want to see characters being fucking brought back. Right. Did you also, I heard this today as well. Sorry, I'm totally hijacking. I heard that fucking Dio.
Yeah.
Ronnie James Dio.
Yep.
They're doing a tour where
it's a hologram?
It's a hologram.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what, though? The thing is.
It looks ridiculous.
The thing is, if people had any fucking respect for Dio, which they should, they would not buy tickets to see this shit show.
It's ridiculous. I can't even believe this is a thing.
I got to see Ronnie James Dio when he was touring with Heaven and Hell,
as
aka Black Sabbath, and I'm so thankful I got to.
Yeah.
Because he left us like not long after that, like maybe a year after I saw him live, and this is fucking ridiculous. This is like when in the 80s they made commercials of fucking Gene Kelly dancing with a fucking vacuum on those commercials. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Just let people fucking be, you know, just let us have our memories. Don't fuck with our memories of them. And that's terrible.
Yeah. But anyway, back to Meatballs.
Sorry, people. So Meatballs, like I said, I always thought it captured the spirit of what I thought summer camp would be. You know, it's got the opening shots of them going, saying goodbye to their parents. And then they meet the cool counselor played by Bill Murray. And, you know, all these fun things. They have all these events. And Chris Makepeace, your buddy, is there as like one of the kids who's kind of like a loner who's taken under the wing of Bill Murray and made to become like happy at camp. And like I said, written by Harold Ramis, Len Blum, and Dan Goldberg. They did Stripes, like I said. And then Len Blum and Dan Goldberg also wrote Heavy Metal.
Oh, okay.
The cartoon. But, you know, I don't love Meatballs, but I like popping it in once in a while because I think it's a pretty fun movie. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't love it.
He said popping it in once in a while.
I don't love balls, but I like popping them in once in a while. For what it is, which is a low-budget Canadian shot camp movie, it's fun. But the reason I wrote it down is because this, like I said, was the movie I saw that made me want to go to summer camp.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, I wish my summer camp experience could have matched it.
Well, it's too bad because, I mean, I kind of get that fantasy that you're talking about with, like, the counselor, like, building the kids up. Because we do see this. It is kind of a trope in, like, movies like this.
Right.
Where we've got, like, the older, like, kind of, like, you know, role model.
Well, they were cool because they were, like, you know, 16 that and would 17. Know
how, and they
know.
Would know how to, like, take the kid that was having the shitty time and make it into the best time ever.
Yeah.
And if those fucking people really existed, my childhood would have been so much better. But you know what? They don't fucking exist. That's why it's a fucking movie. But unfortunately, we don't know this until we're older.
So there was three sequels to this film.
Yes.
The first sequel came 5 years later, and it was about a military camp across the river from a regular camp staging a boxing match for dominance with a E.T. the extraterrestrial ripoff alien in the middle called Meathead.
Really?
Yep.
There's an alien in this?
There's a fucking puppet, like midget in a costume alien called Meathead who looks like...
No, but it's like the character is actually...
It's an alien. It looks like E.T.
So it's like, really?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Thing is, too, it has that. It's got Richard Mulligan from Soap as the head of the military academy. It's got Paul Reubens, who's better known as Pee Wee Herman, as the bus driver for the good camp. And it's directed by Ken Wiederhorn, who made Shockwaves and Squirm.
I did see that. No, he didn't do Squirm. Squirm.
No, not Squirm. Sorry. Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, there's that. Part 3 is Patrick Dempsey, who everyone loved on Grey's Anatomy. Same year he made Can't Buy Me Love, going to summer camp and learning from a dead porn star's ghost, played by Sally Kellerman, how to pick up girls.
I heard Part 3 was set at like a marina.
No, it's at a camp.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it is.
Because I've written down
there's
here,
a marina part
not
to
it. At summer camp.
There's a marina part to it, but I'm pretty sure it's a camp. And the only thing I remember about that is that the dead porn star tells him to stuff a salami down his shorts to make it look like he has a big dick. That's the only scene I remember from
that. But isn't
that
going to be a big disappointment?
I guess so. It's kind of like when girls stuff their bras. Big disappointment.
Like, where do you hide the salami?
Anyway, and then part four was Corey Feldman and Corey Haim at summer camp.
Is Haim in that? I've got written down Corey Feldman.
I think
Sarah Douglas, who was the hot like bad chick from Superman 2.
Right.
And Jack Nance maybe from Eraserhead.
Maybe Haim isn't in it. I'm not sure.
I don't think Haim's in it.
Okay. So there's those. So yeah, Meatballs, like I said, I think Meatballs is on was in my five I picked just as that dream camp movie.
No,
like
I do want to see that. That
ideal camp movie for
me. The fucking fantasy, not reality camp. Yeah.
My number four movie is a movie that I know most people are going to think I'm a fucking moron for putting on my list, but it's a movie I saw at the theater when it came out. The story behind that was, when I was a kid, my family didn't go on a lot of vacations.
Yeah.
And one summer we went on a vacation where we went on a houseboat. You remember houseboats?
Yeah.
Houseboats were basically like an RV on the water. So, and we lived in Ontario, so we went on Lake Ontario, so you could go through the towns and you'd go through the locks, which were kind of cool because they were like mini dams and they'd lift you up and you'd go into the next channel and stuff. We had a night where we stopped overnight and docked and we went to the movies and we went and saw Ernest Goes to Camp.
Oh, dude, really?
I love Ernest Goes to Camp.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not fucking kidding you.
Fuck off.
I love Ernest Goes to Camp.
Fuck him.
I love it.
Why?
I just do.
It's Ernest.
I know, but I love Ernest
Goes to
Camp. Like,
how is he even a thing?
He's not really. He's dead.
He was, though.
So
this was a big deal.
Okay,
how many Ernest movies are there?
Eight.
What?
No, nine. Nine.
Fuck off.
There's nine Ernest movies.
I've never seen any of them.
There's nine. Okay, so anyway.
Didn't it start as like a television commercial?
Yeah, so Jim Varney, who's a comedian, he started playing this character called Ernest, and he was like really like kind of a dunderhead, and he like was like talking to the camera in these commercials like, hey, Vern, you know what I mean? And all this stuff, and he was kind
of... Who's Vern? Do we ever find out?
Never found out. And so... He did that, and then he had, like, these kind of, like, direct-to-video things, and then...
I can't imagine watching a whole movie with this dude.
He had these direct-to-video things, and then he made his big-screen debut in Ernest Goes to Camp. And this is set at Camp Kickakee, and he's, like, this kind of inept handyman who has dreams of becoming a camp counselor. So it's him bumbling around the camp, getting into trouble, trying to become a counselor, and then the nasty land developers come to try and shut down the camp so they can build condos, and it's Ernest versus the developers with the help of the natives who also live on the land, like the Native Americans. So it's obviously not a very high intelligence movie at all. There are scenes in it of Ernest plunging a toilet and then looking in it and going, ew. And, you know, and there's scenes of him launching turtles with parachutes to attack the construction workers.
Oh my god, dude, I can't even imagine. Like,
dude, I like this movie.
Sounds like fucking torture,
but
to me.
I like it.
Oh my god.
So you know, I like it because
I don't even know what to say.
I just I like it because
you Ernest, can't like this.
I do.
Have you watched it recently?
Yes.
No,
dude, I watched it within the last 5 years and I still like it. So it's just because Ernest is such an innocent character that you're just like, he's so likable because he's so dumb. And that's why I like the movie. Stop laughing.
I'm sorry, I'm not trying to put you down. I just don't understand.
I know. I knew this would be the one where you'd be like, what the fuck? What's he thinking of? But, you know, I just really have fun with
this
movie.
That's good. I'm glad.
He did, like I said, he did eight sequels. Ernest Goes to Ernest Saves Christmas was the next one, and then it was like Ernest Goes to Jail, Ernest Scared Stupid, Ernest Rides Again, Ernest Goes to Africa, Slam Dunk Ernest, blah 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 blah. People really love Saves Christmas, and Scared Stupid are the two that people like. This is the only one I can watch.
Wow.
The shtick wore out a long time before the movies did. Let's put it that way. They were all directed by this guy called John Cherry, though. He directed all eight, all
John
nine of
Cherry?
The
movies.
John.
Oh.
He directed all nine of the movies. I think he was like a producer co-partner with Jim Varney. And, you know, Jim Varney was actually a pretty good actor in like other comedies. He was like a fun guy to watch. He was in this movie called Fast Food.
Right.
Which co-stars Tracy Lords and is directed by Michael A. Simpson, who made Sleepaway Camp 2 and 3.
Okay.
And that's a pretty fun movie. He's been in other movies where he's a lot of fun. And I just like this movie, okay? And I shouldn't have to apologize for that, but this was a movie, like I said, I have a good memory attached to it to begin with.
Right.
And that kind of helps.
Yes, that always does.
My family, like I said, barely went on vacations.
Yeah, yeah.
So to be able to go on this really cool vacation and see a movie like this was a lot of fun.
That's good.
And I think that's why it carries over today. You have nothing to say about Ernest apart from like, what the fuck?
So I don't. It almost made me want to watch one.
You should watch Ghost of Camp,
just
dude.
To try and
just
understand.
Watch it.
I don't know if I could do it. But
if millions of people are watching fucking Adam Sandler movies on Netflix,
I'm not one of them.
They can watch Ernest Goes to Camp, for fuck's sake. That's all I'm saying. Okay, number three on my list is The Burning.
Okay.
Which I know you still probably...
I've never seen it.
So this is a slasher movie set at a summer camp. It's taken from the urban legend of Cropsey, which is a New York, like New Jersey, New York kind of urban legend about a caretaker who gets burned and then comes back to kill people. And that's what this movie is. Like, it opens at a summer camp. And
so is that documentary Cropsey about this?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's about the same urban legend. That's a great documentary, by the way.
Do you see the parallels in the documentary with the burning?
No, this isn't a glow situation here.
No, I was just curious. Like,
Very loosely. Okay. So this is a cash in on Friday the 13th, admittedly. It's Cropsey's the caretaker at a camp. As a prank, he gets burnt in his cabin one day and gets, you know, burnt up and deformed. And
that's
then
a funny prank.
And I know, aren't they always? And then years later, he comes back to get his revenge on the people who did it when they were returning to the camp as adults to kind of like be counselors. Now, the group of actors here is pretty impressive considering it's like most of them their film debuts. You got Holly Hunter.
Right.
You've got Jason Alexander, who went on to be on Seinfeld. And you've got Fisher Stevens, who I mostly know him from Short Circuit, but he's done a lot of other cool stuff. It's also notable for being written by Bob and Harry Weinstein, who went on to form Miramax.
Okay.
Who produced and who distributed a lot of like really cool movies in the 90s when they started, like Clerks and Pulp Fiction and things like that.
Movie moguls,
yeah.
I did not know that.
But they co-wrote The Burning.
Huh.
It's also got Lee Ayers as one of the actresses in it. Most people my age would know her as the love interest in Van Damme's Bloodsport, but she was in a bunch of TV shows too. And, you know, it's got a Rick Wakeman score.
Isn't Brian Backer in this?
Yes, he is.
Mark Ratner from Fast Times at Ridgemont.
Yeah, he's in this too. Rick Wakeman's score.
All right.
Rick Wakeman was in Yes and a bunch of other prog stuff like that.
Yeah,
and, you know, your killer's a burnt-up guy with fucking hedge clippers. What more do you need? So he basically runs around chopping people up with these hedge clippers. Gore effects by Tom Savini.
Yeah.
Really awesome fucking raft scene that was, for the longest time, not available on the R-rated cut. It was only when MGM put this out on DVD back in 2003 or 2004 that you got this scene, and it's so epic. I really like The Burning. It's one of my like go-tos when I want to feel like a 80s slasher movie, and the fact that it's set at a camp makes it even better.
Yeah.
And it's a fun movie, and it's got a lot of, like I mentioned, it's got a lot of names involved in it that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a good one.
No, I gotta see this one.
You have the Scream Factory Blu-ray, don't you?
No, I have the MGM DVD.
Oh, okay.
But I haven't cracked it, so I keep wanting to buy the Scream Factory one.
Right.
But then I'm like, did I already buy this shit? So I don't know if I own it. So I have to figure that shit out.
This is the problem with being a collector and buying too much shit. You sometimes forget what you have.
So I have that app now.
Oh, okay.
But it's, I don't know where this would be. So I need to, I think, actually, I just, as we were talking about, I was thinking, I'm just going to check my Amazon purchase history. And if I've never bought it, I'll just fucking buy it. Because I do want to see this. And like, right. It sounds like that Scream Factory disc is the definitive version. So
it is. So there's that. My number two movie I wrote down is from 1980 called Little Darlings.
Right.
Starring Tatum O'Neill and Christy McNichol as two 15-year-old girls from different aspects of life. So Tatum O'Neill's the rich girl. Christy McNichol's the rebellious, cigarette-smoking, dirt bike-riding girl, and they make a bet at summer camp about who's going to lose their virginity first.
Yeah.
The targets of this is Matt Dillon from My Bodyguard is one of them, and the other one is Armand Assante from I, the Jury, one of Josh's favorites. And the reason this movie is notable is that it's got your typical summer camp stuff in it. You know, it's got the food fights and it's got the, you know, having fun, going swimming and all that stuff. But it's got all these like really like frank discussions about sex and them being vulgar and dirty with each other. And they're like 15-year-old girls. And in 1980, you don't expect to see a movie that does this.
Yeah.
It was written by women, which is also pretty rare for this time frame for this type of movie. It was spun off into a 1982. It was remade, I think, as a 1982 TV movie,
which I found
is extremely weird to 2 years later make a TV movie out of this. And it's also a movie that has never been on anything past VHS.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why, but from what I get, it might be music rights.
Well, I heard it's got a pretty killer soundtrack. I do have the VHS of this. I've just never seen it.
I think it's music rights that is causing this from not coming out. But this, I know, is a title that if somebody was to pick this up, I think it would sell really well. Because a lot of people like me have a lot of nostalgia about this movie. And I also thought it's notable because it does have a lot of, like, you know, more adult kind of language and talk than you would expect from a movie about two 15-year-old girls at summer camp trying to get laid.
Right.
Basically. And, you know, you can't really go wrong with early Tatum O'Neill stuff.
Yeah.
And I really like Christy McNichol, too, in this era. Like, she was in a lot of fun stuff then, too. And you know.
The pirate movie, man.
The pirate movie. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Roman Polanski's gem.
No, not the Polanski one.
Oh, no, that's Pirates. What's the pirate movie?
It was another
one. That's the one with what's-his-face from Blue Lagoon, right?
Christopher Atkins.
Yeah. No, pirate movie. Never mind.
That on VHS, too.
Great. Maybe it'll be a VHS adventure one day.
Probably. Actually, yeah, that might be coming soon.
So Little Darlings, I would really like to see get a Blu-ray release so that people can discover it, because I think it's worthwhile. And my number one is the most obvious one, and the one that I had to put number one is the original Friday the 13th.
Really?
Yeah.
That's your number one?
That's my number one summer camp movie.
See, I don't know. I was kind of on the fence on that one because I'm like, the only one that where there was actually children there was four.
No, there's kids in six. Because there's a scene near in the finale of six, they do end up at the campsite. And there's a scene where Jason goes into one of the cabins and all the kids are sleeping.
Yeah, that was six.
Yeah, that was
okay.
Jason Lives.
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
So, no, I think I'd say that Friday the 13th for me is the definitive summer camp movie, because
even though there's no real summer camp,
even though there's no, well, it's in a summer camp,
but they're just preparing for that.
Well, it's still a summer camp though.
Okay.
And say what you will about Friday the 13th. It's not my favorite.
Friday the 13th.
No, but it's not my favorite of the series.
Jason, I love the first one.
Jason Lives is my favorite, but I do really like Friday the 13th. I think it set the groundwork for a lot of the slasher movies that followed it, like The Burning, was from this template. I think, you know, Tom Savini's work in this is amazing. I think Betsy Palmer's work in this is amazing. I think Harry Manfredi's score is so iconic now that you can't avoid it when you think of horror movies.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's just a really great movie. And the thing is that the reason I picked this as a summer camp movie is because it adds adds to the atmosphere of this movie, because you see them going to the summer camp. You see them trying to set up the cabins and getting it set. There's archery ranges. There's all that stuff that you would have in a summer camp.
Yeah.
But it's set in such a, it's such a dark and foreboding place because there's a killer on the loose.
Yeah.
And that's why I picked it, because like, we go from my ideal memory of summer camps for Meatballs to my reality memory of summer camp, which is Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I balanced it on my personal list.
Yeah.
So that's why I put Friday the 13th as the ultimate summer camp movie, because I picture summer camp as a fucking terrible kill me now kind of situation. And that's why what Friday the 13th is.
I love the original Friday the 13th.
I do really like the original.
People rip on it, and I don't understand.
I do. I like the original. It's got great gore. It's got, you know, that shock ending that works every time.
It's got Crazy Ralph.
And well, Crazy Ralph's in part two as well.
It's not the same.
It's got a death curse.
It's not the same in part two.
and you know, and seriously, Betsy Palmer is so damn good in that movie. Like, so good.
It's really good, and I love the counselors in it as well. I love the opening kill.
Yep.
Yeah, I like the guy who, that creepy guy in the yellow jacket who, like, runs the camp.
Yeah.
I think it's Adrian King was the lead, right?
In
the part one,
Yep.
Love that one.
Yeah, I really like the first one, too, but for me personally, like, with the Friday movies, everybody has a different favorite, it seems.
It's true, but I do find people rip on the original a bit.
I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't like that. Because it really did set the tone.
I think that people rip on the original because Jason is not the killer.
Yeah.
I think that's what the thing is. But the thing is, too, is that to go from that framework of the killer's reveal to having... to be able to spin those series off to making Jason the killer was pretty ingenious.
Yeah.
And you know, and even though it's, in theory, it's fucking ridiculous, they still pulled it off.
They did.
So, you know, that's my top five summer camp movies. What other ones do you have that you want to talk about?
Well, it's interesting because had I had a top five,
yep,
I'll tell you a few that would have been on it.
Okay.
Friday the 13th, the original, just like you did.
Yep.
For sure. Sleepaway Camp.
I was going to put that, but I figured if you came up with a top five, that would be on it. I had a feeling you'd put Friday too, but I was like, I don't want to have two of the same slasher movies.
So Sleepaway Camp kind of to me is like the ultimate, at least now I haven't seen The Burning, but as far as like horror summer camp, this one really, because it's got kids everywhere.
Well, and this one also is kind of like our experience at summer camp because there's so many fucking horrible bullies in it, too.
Yeah, we're like the Angela.
Yeah, we're like the Angelas, but she has a bigger dick than us.
Wow.
Just saying.
Even I could probably say that. Anyway.
I'm just kidding on that one. If you haven't seen Sleepaway Camp, sorry for the spoiler.
Wow, yeah. That was a major spoiler.
Yeah.
Anyway,
if you've been with us through 71 episodes, you know we've talked about Sleepaway Camp in the past, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, I like Sleepaway Camp.
I do like Sleepaway Camp.
I had seen the original. I don't know if I had seen the sequels, but if you've listened to the show lots, then you know that I have seen the sequels recently.
Yeah.
But the original one is a really solid slasher movie.
I always remembered the video box for the original. Always made me afraid to rent it.
What was the video box?
Because the video box was like, it was a letter home to mom in the background.
Yeah.
And then it was a knife.
And a shoe.
A bloody knife with a shoe hanging on it.
Yeah.
And I always remember that video box. And I was always like, this movie's going to fuck me up. I can't watch this. And then sure enough, it fucked me up in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah. So it's about this girl who's like kind of traumatized as a child. She ends up going to summer camp with her cousin.
Yeah, cousin.
Yeah.
And because she's super quiet, she gets picked on, obviously.
Yeah, so she gets picked on and made fun of, and her cousin's kind of standing up for her lots.
Yeah, and people who pick on her get killed systematically. Yeah.
And then she kind of has a thing for one of the other campers, played by I think that's the guy from Firstborn, right? Christopher Collette.
Who's also in Manhattan Project, which we mentioned last episode.
Yeah, so she kind of has a bit of a romance, but, you know, shit goes wrong. The thing I liked about this as a summer camp movie is it had the counselors.
Yep.
It had all the activities, but it also had the fucking campers. Yep. And I just found, like, with a lot of the horror ones, it was like Friday the 13th.
Well, it was mostly just counselors setting up for the kids.
Yeah, we weren't seeing the activities of summer camp. It was just set in a summer camp. Whereas this one was actually at a working summer camp. So we saw the pervy cook, and we saw like all the
that guy gives me skeebies.
Yeah,
heebie jeebies.
He's gross.
I know.
I can't remember what his line is, but it was disgusting.
It's something like something about sweet meat or something. It's pretty gross.
Yeah. And but we get to see like them playing at the beach and stuff like that.
Baseball and in a big padding scene though, that baseball scene. It's like 10 minutes of them playing baseball that was kind of just there for padding.
True. But it does establish that Ricky gets a little freaky once in a while.
Ricky gets through angry. The whole fucking movie.
He has a short fuse.
He does. He's always like calling people cocksuckers and stuff like that through the whole damn movie.
Yeah. But it's a great flick, and
it's a lot of fun.
One that I kind of discounted for a lot of my life, and then because I did see it when I was young, but I don't know, I kind of blew it off back then.
So did I.
Maybe because of my summer camp hell.
So did I too, though. That's one that when I was going through my phase and when I was a kid of watching slasher movies and stuff, I didn't like.
Yeah,
I didn't really come around to that one until I was older.
Yeah, older though, I really dig it. It's one of my favorite slasher films now, actually. So there you go. So, and there was two sequels.
There was three sequels.
Yeah, I don't...
Return to Sleepaway Camps.
That third one confuses me. I still haven't been able to see it, but...
Okay, so here's the story of this. There was a 1983 original, then there was the two that were shot back-to-back in 88 and 89. With Pamela Springsteen. Then they were making a part four, but they only filmed about 20 to 25 minutes of footage, and it never got released. Then in 2008, I think it is, the original director came back and made Return to Sleepaway Camp,
right?
Which is a part four. And then since then, one of the guys who runs one of those Sleepaway Camp websites pieced together another Sleepaway Camp movie from like the footage that was aborted originally and called it part four. It's very confusing.
Yeah.
So really the series is just Sleepaway Camp 1, 2, 3 and Return to Sleepaway Camp. That's the series.
Okay. Got it.
So, and Return, unfortunately, even though it's the same director as part one, didn't do it for me.
Yeah. And I mean, I think you like the sequels quite a bit.
I like part two, but I don't like part three.
Yeah. They were okay, but the original was kind of where it's at for me.
Yeah. I don't like part three, but I do like part two because it's got the Happy Camper song. It's some of the deaths in it I dug.
Yeah.
Plus, it's got that chick who, like, just nails everybody, and then she's like, "You don't have AIDS, do you?" After she has sex with that guy in the woods.
AIDS talk.
And he's like, "No," and she's like, "Great, that was fun," and then leaves.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Okay, so another one that I thought about immediately when we came up with this topic, and I did run this by you to see if it would be legitimate in this topic, was Cheerleader Camp from 1988.
Yep.
I did like this one quite a bit because it's pretty off the wall. And this is about, it's not about a summer camp per se, but it's about a cheerleader camp. So it's about a bunch of cheerleaders.
But they're it's technically set at a summer camp because where they go is in the woods and it's got cabins and so on and so forth.
Yeah. It has like bathing by the, by the waterfall or whatever.
It's kind of like a rock outcropping that they all bathe at, and you know, they take their tops off to sunbathe, and there's the fat comic relief guy out in the woods like spying on them dressed as a woman for no real reason that I can think of.
I can't remember who that guy was in this.
Yeah, Sleepaway Camp, I watch
Cheerleader Camp,
sorry. I've seen it a bunch of times, and I don't love it, but if it's on, I'll watch it. It's not very good, but I'll still watch it if it's on.
I do like parts of it. I mean, one thing that's notable is at that rock outcropping, there's one of the friends is played by porn star Terry Weigel.
Right.
Who does show her Weigels at that, as she said.
And one of the... So in the movie, it's about cheerleaders, the cheerleader squads, and the mascots. And one of the mascots is played by Lucinda Dickey.
From Breakin'.
From Breakin' 1 and 2 and Ninja 3, The Domination.
Yeah, which is pretty great.
Yep.
It's also got Leif Garrett, the troubled child star.
Yep.
And Betsy Russell is the star of this.
And the man, George Buck Flower, shows up as the skeezy caretaker.
Yeah.
Any movie with George Buck Flower instantly gets some cred points.
That's true. Yeah, and he's always kind of creepy.
And he always plays like either the homeless guy or the creepy janitor or something along those lines, but you always know it's him when he shows up.
Yeah, and this movie did make an impression on me. Like not a huge impression, but I do remember this one.
Well, and I remember, too, that the main character in this movie always has, like, these dream sequences, which are like inspired by the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, because it's always like her being like slashed by her pom poms while this maniacal laughing goes on in the background. And I'm like, that's totally a Nightmare on Elm Street influenced moment right there.
Yeah.
So it's okay. It's not like great, but
it's not fantastic. I do remember the review.
It's a late 80s slasher movie. So if you're a slasher aficionado, you know what that means. Like the quality kind of went downhill in the late 80s.
Yeah, and the reveal was pretty good in this one, too, I thought. So, yeah. So, it is the one, again, from someone who hasn't seen a lot of summer camp movies. Right. I did think of this one right away. So, just a few others. Poison Ivy is one I did see.
With Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
Reiterate. Not the Drew Barrymore one directed by Kat Shee.
Yeah. This was a 1985 TV movie, actually.
And it had all the sitcom teenagers of the time.
Yeah.
Because it was Michael J. Fox, who was on Family Ties. It was Nancy McKeon from Facts of Life.
Yeah.
And who else was
Adam
in it?
Adam Baldwin.
Yeah.
Robert Klein, not a sitcom star. But I just remember this one.
I remember watching it when it originally aired, but this is one I've always wanted to actually rewatch. But
I liked it when I was young.
It's another one of those movies that I don't think got past VHS.
Yeah, and I remember Fox and McKeon were in a couple of movies. They were in this one, and they were in one called High School USA.
Oh, I remember that one,
and
too.
And I really, really liked both of these movies when I was young.
Yeah, so did I.
So High School USA was a high school, and I remember like they were at a fair and stuff like that. And then this was kind of another version of the same story, but at a summer camp. And I did enjoy this one as well. So I do remember this. So we've got a lot of the ones you've mentioned. Just in researching this topic, there were a few more that I thought I'd just bring up. Madman.
Yep.
From
That's a pretty decent little slasher flick,
1987,
too.
1987, directed by Joe Giannon. I haven't seen this one.
I have the Arrow Blu-ray at home.
Have you watched it? Have you ever seen this?
I haven't watched the Blu-ray, but I've seen the movie a couple times. It's another one that's based on an urban legend, because it's based on the urban legend of Madman Mars.
Okay.
It's got some pretty good kill stuff in it, if I recall. I haven't seen it in a while.
It's definitely one I feel it's like I should have seen.
It's one that's gained pretty good following over the years. Like it was put out on Blu-ray in the UK by Arrow, and it was put out by Vinegar Syndrome on Blu-ray in North America here.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got quite a cult following.
I have a version of this somewhere.
Anchor Bay put it out on DVD too, so that might be what you have. But it's a pretty decent little slasher movie, because it's one of those ones where like the killer is like a really like super burly, like overall wearing
like
kinda,
a slaughterhouse worker
kind of
and redneck.
I remember there's this really cool like scene that works where he's like hanging a guy from a tree branch, so it's like the scene of him pulling him to hang him from the tree branch,
right?
And I remember that scene was really tense.
Okay.
And there's another scene where the chicks, I think it's one of the girls that's trying to hide in a cabin from him, so it's like kind of that, you know how Jurassic Park did with the raptors where they're hiding and you could see them hiding but you could see the killer looking around for them.
Yeah
they had something like that in this Madman movie that I thought was effective too, that I remember.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it stars Galen Ross from Dawn of the Dead. So yeah. I didn't know that. So That's Mad Men. One of the early trauma movies called The First Turn On took place at a summer camp.
I haven't seen that.
Directed by Lloyd Kaufman and Michael Hirst.
That was his, like, they did a string of, like, kind of sex comedies in the late 70s, early 80s, like The First Turn On, Squeeze Play, which was a baseball-themed one, Battle of the Sexes one, Waitress, which was set in a restaurant, and then...
Stuck on You was the fourth one.
Stuck on You, which was like, I think it was like someone about this, like, invention that makes girls super hot for you or something. If
I don't remember.
I saw them when I was a kid, and I haven't seen them since, and I keep meaning that they were released on DVD by Troma in this thing called the Sexy Box.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I kept meaning to pick it up, but now it's out of print, and I'm not willing to spend the kind of money people want for it now, so.
Yeah, so there's a Troma summer camp movie.
Yep.
Another one of note is, this is more of like a going back to summer camp movie called Indian Summer.
Yeah, I've seen this too.
From 1993, directed by Mike Binder. So this is a tale of...
It's kind of like The Big Chill at summer
camp.
Yeah,
that's what it sounded like to me, The Big Chill at summer camp, where you've got a group of people that used to go to summer camp together having a reunion at summer camp and kind of reminiscing.
Right.
But a fantastic cast in this. We've got Alan Arkin, Matt Craven, Diane Lane, Bill Paxton, Elizabeth Perkins, Kevin Pollak, Vincent Spano, and director Sam Raimi. So I've never seen this.
I know you can get this on really cheap Blu-ray double feature or something from Mill Creek.
Definitely want to check it out
and,
after reading the cast.
Another one that came out around that same time that it seems like people really love from 1994 is this movie called Heavyweights.
Yeah.
Starring Ben Stiller.
And people really like that one.
It's like a fat camp.
Yeah.
Kind of like a summer camp movie. So it's like basically it's a bunch of overweight kids who go to camp. And Ben Stiller's like the main counselor who's trying to help them lose weight. And all these hijinks occur. And when I was looking into this topic too, it seems like a lot of people really love that movie.
They do.
I saw it when I was younger and I don't remember anything about it, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So...
couple more, a more recent one is called Wet Hot American Summer, which is a kind of a throwback.
That's a pretty fun little flick.
Again, pretty hell of a cast on this one. So this came from David Wick, who's, one of the guys from The State.
Yeah. And, it was co-written by, Michael Showalter, who also was involved with The State and who also directed The Big Sick, which I mentioned earlier in this episode.
Yeah. And The State was, they were like a comedy, like a sketch comedy troupe, kind of like, Saturday Night Live or
just a little bit more edgy. A little bit more edgy, I think.
Yeah, kind of like Broken Lizard, I guess, would be a better comparison. But I mean, again, hell of a cast: Janine Garofalo, David Hyde Pierce, Molly Shannon, Paul Rudd, Christopher Maloney, Elizabeth Banks, Bradley Cooper, Amy Poehler.
Wet Hot American Summer is a pretty good flick, and they spun it off into a Netflix series too.
And there's another Netflix series coming. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I definitely want to check this one out. Again, I don't know why I actually own this one, but I don't know why I just haven't gotten around to it. We were talking earlier about one called Gorp.
Yep.
From 1982.
That's pretty awful.
Yeah. So, directed by Joseph Rubin, who did The Stepfather and The Good Son. Yep.
This is pre all of those. He also did Sleeping with the Enemy.
Right.
But this is like way before.
I love the cover for this. Like the cover makes
the cover
is
awesome
because
it's like looks like a Mad Magazine picture.
Totally.
But the movie itself is pretty lousy, but it's got a couple of notable people in it.
Yeah.
If I recall.
Dennis Quaid.
Yep.
Rosanna Arquette.
Yep.
Fran Drescher. But it's also got Michael Lembeck, who I remember from a sweet little Gary Coleman gem called On the Right Track.
Oh, yeah. On the Right Track.
And it has Julius Harris, who was he was kind of a blaxploitation staple. Bond fans will remember him as Teehee from Live and Let Die, the guy with the hook. So he appears in this as well. A couple more I just wanted to throw out there. One is, I know Chris and I have watched this together, called Party Camp.
Yep.
But
that's a for what it is, it's pretty amusing at times.
Pretty amusing, but I don't remember a lot about it.
No.
1987.
Billy Jacoby's the main star. Billy Jacoby was like, he played the smart-ass brother in a lot of 80s movies, like just one of the guys and stuff like that.
And reckless.
And he was also one of the killers in Bloody Birthday.
Right, right.
I like Billy.
Yeah, we talked about him on the last episode.
I like Billy Jacoby.
Yeah. Also has Jewel Shepherd in it. It was directed by Gary Graver, who was a cinematographer who worked with Orson Welles and Fred Olen Ray. I also remember that the one thing I remember about this is that the nurse was super hot.
Yeah.
Played by April Wayne, and she ended up marrying Billy Jacoby in real life.
So. Oh, okay.
One that I read about that I haven't seen is called Summer Camp Nightmare.
Yeah, I've seen this. It's pretty cool. It's a Roger Corman produced Lord of the Flies take.
Yeah, I'm super interested in this one.
Because they kind of advertised it as a horror movie.
What?
Huh? They advertised it as a horror movie, but it's not.
Well, it sounds sort of like...
it's like Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like one camp decides, I think they're going to overthrow the...
Counselors.
Yep. And then I think there's another camp down the road, a girls' camp or something, and shit goes down. The thing that most interests me about this is that it was co-written by Penelope Spheris, who's one of my favorite directors of the 80s, of that time period. Like, she had a lot of really cool shit at that time. So I didn't even know about this movie. So there's that one, Summer Camp Nightmare. I know people really love this one as well, but I don't. But it's called Final Girls. That's a really recent movie, and there is some
stuff. I thought it was okay.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
I didn't love it, but I thought it was okay.
Yeah, I thought it was extremely, extremely overrated. But it's set at a summer camp. As did you. I remember you didn't like it much.
What, Final Girls?
Yeah.
I thought it was okay, but I didn't love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I thought there was moments of it that I liked, because it was, like, kind of, like, doing a piss take on slasher movies, like, making fun of them a little bit. And I liked some... I thought it was creative at times doing that, but then I just thought it, like, went on a little bit too long, and then it got too serious in the finale.
Yeah.
That's what my problems were with it. Like, it was trying to be a spoof of slasher movies, and then in the last half an hour it decided to try and be a real slasher movie, and it kind of didn't gel.
No.
That's the main thing I remember.
It didn't work for me at all.
Plus, it's got that Adam Devine guy in it, and I don't really care for him.
Yeah.
He kind of annoys me.
Yeah, he annoys me too.
Yeah.
The last one I'm going to mention is one called Happy Campers from 2001. Haven't seen this one, but again, I'm kind of intrigued by who's behind it. So we've got Daniel Walters as the director, and he was the writer of Heathers, which is a movie I really love. But again, really great cast in this one: Brad Renfro, Dominique Swain, Emily Bergel, who was Carrie in the sequel,
and she
was
also on Carrie 2.
The Rage Carrie 2. She also had a good part in the TV show Southland. Jamie King, Justin Long, and Peter Stormare. So again, another really great cast. The one thing about these summer camp movies, I gotta say, is that a lot of them just have these like killer casts.
Well, because they're all ensemble movies.
Ensembles, yeah. So I do kind of want to check some of these out now. Don't know if I will, seeing as it's just like a season I'm not a fan of, but I might try and get over my hump on the summer camp movies and check some of these.
At least watch The Burning, dude.
Yeah, I'll check out The Burning.
All right. So there's our little summer camp reminiscing. And as usual, at the end of an episode, I'm going to do the spiel. And here it comes, people. If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just search for GBW Podcast. You can also go to our website at gbwpodcast.com. And hit us up on iTunes. Give us a rating and review, because every little bit helps. And on that note,
if someone did one on every episode, we'd have 70.
And that'd be awesome.
But we have 4.
But you know what we're going to no, we have more than 4. But you know what we're going to do right now, Josh? We're going to get ourselves wrapped in some sleeping bags, and we're going to piss ourselves. That's what's going to happen.
Well, I've drank enough beer that could happen.
Okay, people, until next time.